We ready? The Senate will please come to order. Game over. Called on account of rain. Reports from standing committees.
February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals Business Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 153, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Fecht, Larson, and Vasey, Senator Larson, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Elections and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 61, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, DeCarrier, and Scott. No, Senators Cooper and Larson, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number eight, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred House Bill 135, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Geis, Hastert, Johnson, Landon, Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred House Bill 136, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Geis, Hastert, Johnson, Landon, Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred House Bill 51, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Geis, Hastert, Johnson, Landon, Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred House Bill 142, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Geis, Hastert, Johnson, Landon, and Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Joint Resolution 6, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Cooper, DeCarrier, Larson, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President. House Bill 153, Engrossed Economic Development Account 2, has an appropriation, and I would request it be re-referred to Committee 2 Appropriations.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 153 is re-referred to Committee Number 2 Appropriations. We have one more standing committee report, it appears.
February 28th, I misread this one. This was Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Joint Resolution 6, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Cooper, DeCarrier, and Larson, excuse, Senator Scott, Senator Chase, Chairman.
Okay.
Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we're at that order of business of consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move the Senate resolve itself into the Committee of the Whole.
You have all heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. Committee of the Whole, please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution 1. The reading clerk will please read the joint resolution.
A House Joint Resolution 1, Initiative and Referendum Requirements, sponsored by Representative Brown, a joint resolution proposing to amend the Wyoming Constitution to modify the signature requirement for a petition for an inactive initiative or referendum. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCarrier, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions. Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the joint resolution. What is your pleasure, Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a do pass recommendation on House Joint Resolution 1, and would yield the floor to the President of the Senate.
Thank you, Senator Ross. President Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, what this resolution does, it asks for a constitutional amendment that goes into our referendum process, and it asks that rather than using at least, and the bulk of it is over on page 2, lines 14 and 15 and through 18. Right now, in order to get a referendum on the ballot, you need 15% of those resident in at least two-thirds of the counties of the state. And what we're proposing is to change it to two-thirds of the Senate districts. And the reason we're doing that is that if you look at the counties in this state, the population disparity is very large. And just on either end of the spectrum, you have a Niobrara County with relatively few, about 3,000 residents, and on the other end of the spectrum, you've got a Natrona or a Laramie County with somewhere in excess of 50,000. What happens then is if you choose to try and get a referendum, in effect, it's possible that you no longer are complying with the one-man, one-vote concept that is well established in court law in this nation, particularly as it applies to referendums and elections. Because all Senate districts cover roughly 19,000, I think it is, or 18,211 voters, it means that each one of those entities represents the same number of people, so we're getting more towards one man, one vote in terms of the referendum process. In looking over the referendum process, understand, Mr. Chairman, only 27 states have this process at all. So that's we're kind of looking at a very limited case law. But what we have, particularly in the Rocky Mountain region, is both Idaho and Montana have been taken to federal court. Idaho ended up going exactly what we're doing, going with senatorial districts. Montana, which is a very wise state with many, many very wise residents, were found to be legal, one man, one vote. And then they went ahead and changed it. So now they're not in compliance. But we have both ends of the spectrum with all of the wisdom to the north and to the west of us. I think we should learn, though, when you start talking about federal decisions, that's what we're talking about, is we do have to comply with one man, one vote. In the committee, there was some discussion, does this make it more difficult or less difficult or more transparent in the initiative process? And quite frankly, no one can tell you whether it does or doesn't. It's obviously easier if you go into a Niobrara County, for example, to get 15% of the voters in Niobrara County. In terms of the total requirement, it's pretty debatable. But let me go back a little bit in history. In the early 90s, 93, I believe it was, we had two referendums on the ballot. One was brought by the railroad interests, and one was brought by the trucking industry. And they were it's hard to imagine, but they were kind of going head to head. I forget who filed it first, but the other one went after the other industry. And what happened was they gathered the signatures pretty much in the railroad corridor on the southern part of the state. And I'll use myself as an example. When I went to vote in Johnson County, I hadn't heard anything about it because they could go right down the corridor and never get any real public participation in the discussions, in the programs leading up to either one of those initiatives. It turned out both of them, as the legislature started dealing with them, for all practical purposes, they were very poorly constructed initiatives, and they fell by the wayside statutorily, and I think that was the right thing to have happen. What we're proposing here is that you truly do have to run at least somewhat a statewide campaign. You can't go in and just pluck out those high population counties, nor can you go in and pick out the low population counties and say we're going to meet the requirement for a referendum. I think if we ever do get into federal court, and that's where this ends up if somebody challenges it, so long as we are in violation of the one man, one vote, probably we will lose that decision. It's well established. The federal courts are extremely supportive of one man, one vote. This is kind of looking ahead. Has the initiative process been tremendously popular in this state? It really hasn't been. Excuse me. However, Mr. Chairman will recall that about a year and a half ago, I think it was, when we were discussing the sales tax on food, the referendum idea came up again, the initiative to put that tax in place. Turned out it wasn't necessary. But let me suggest to you, the idea is out there. The potential to have somebody use it is out there. Let's make sure that we have a constitution that will withstand challenge in the federal courts if somebody elects to go the initiative process. That's the extent of what we're asking for a change in our constitution. Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through and read the whole bill. That's the essence of it, and I'll certainly stand for questions.
Questions for President Schiffer? Questions? I don't see any questions. We do have a committee of the whole amendment. Senators, let's have that amendment read in, please.
House Joint Resolution 1, Committee of the Whole Committee of the Whole Amendment 1, page 1, line 5.
Thank you. Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Joint Resolution number 1 and ask for your support. As I said in committee, and having been involved in trying to get enough signatures to put the food tax on the ballot this previous couple of years, as we went forward and we went through all of the hoops that we go through in the state of Wyoming in order to do this, I thought to myself afterwards, I thought, well, if we're going to put this into our Senate districts, and I think one man, one vote, I think that's the thing that we have to do. I thought we ought to at least consider lowering the 15% to 10% of the registered voters in the last election. I come to you with this because we have the highest threshold of voters of anyone in the nation. The next one highest is 10% in Alaska, Arizona, Maine, and Nevada. The lowest percent of voters is in North Dakota with 2%, a western state. Average is 7%. So I would like us to consider lowering that 15% threshold to 10%. I know that we have had some unfortunate experiences maybe with this process, but the people who originally wrote this Constitution gave us and gave their constituents and gave the people in the state of Wyoming the right to do this process. And I think that we only make it that it shouldn't be so prohibitive or so out of line with what everyone else has done that we should lower this to 10%. We still will have the highest threshold in the nation. But there are lots of other things that we do. We have time limits on this process. We have to keep going to the notary to have each page notarized. We have a lot of barriers in this process. And in addition to those barriers, we have the geographic locations and the way the state is spread out that makes it very, very difficult to gather signatures and enough of them. And so I would urge your support for lowering the 15% threshold to 10%. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Sessions. Discussion on the amendment? President Schiffer?
Mr. Chairman, in addressing this amendment, you know, if you want to talk about barriers to initiatives, go visit 23 other states where there are no initiatives. I mean, there's none. So is it a barrier? Not particularly. But let me, earlier this year, at a meeting of the Council of State Governments, and Mr. Chairman, that's an opportunity to visit with other legislators, specifically legislators from Colorado.
Was that where we visited with the guy from Louisiana before?
That could have been from Louisiana, although Louisiana is not the one I was going to focus on. Mr. Chairman, in visiting with Colorado legislators, and I'm not going to quote them exactly, but what I was told is in Colorado, and this was an observation, and I'll paraphrase it, from a legislator down there. In Colorado, the legislature does not make policy anymore. Initiatives make policy, and they legislate around the edges. I do not believe we want to go that route. We have a standard. It is a reasonable standard. 15% is a reasonable standard. Is it real lax? No, it's not. It's a fairly high standard, but this state has high standards, I submit. It's certainly a more lax standard than in 23 other states where there is no avenue for initiative. I think also we need to look carefully at the initiative process. We have seen some initiatives that, for all practical purposes, were impossible to translate into statutory language, either because of the wording, because of the vested interests that were promoting them. So we don't want to make it too easy. We're easier than 23 other states. It's a reasonable standard where it's at. 15% is a nice round number. I ask you to resist this amendment.
Thank you, President Schiffer. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I too rise to oppose this particular amendment. Mr. Chairman, the process we've got now works. We've had it since 1967. It has been used sparingly, but it has been used very effectively a couple of times that, to my personal knowledge. First was an in-stream flow when, for procedural reasons, it was just impossible to get a bill to the floor to the vote in the legislature. They collected enough signatures, and it was done as a citizen's volunteer effort. And when that happened, then reasonable legislation came forward and got passed. The second was more recently, and frankly, on the sales tax off groceries, the representative that was representative from the other half of my Senate district did a very skillful job putting together an initiative, and I know I helped circulate. I walked some of the streets in my district knocking on doors and getting people to sign that petition. And then once that initiative was well underway and it became quite apparent where the people stood on it, then that representative and our colleague, who's now been promoted, got together and got it through the legislature. So it again, that's an example of a citizens' initiative working under our current laws. So what we've got now works, and we have not had the problems that they have had elsewhere. And you just look at our neighbors south of the border. They've had some initiatives passed that are almost inconsistent. You know, there's a mandate on K-12 education combined with a limit on total spending that gives them an impossibility in terms of striking a decent balance, and it is doing tremendous damage to their higher education system. And you've seen similar problems in the other states. You make it too easy, becomes the route that every special interest that has little money follows to try to get their particular things legislated in isolation with a big TV campaign, and people don't understand some of the unexpected adverse consequences of some of these things that you have to take into consideration when you legislate. So I think the experience has shown we in Wyoming have struck the right balance in terms of having a process, but having it difficult enough to use so that it hasn't been abused. So for those reasons, Mr. Chairman, I would urge us to defeat this amendment.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Mockler.
Mr. Chairman, and obviously I support the amendment and hate the bill. And part of the reason is, when you look at the very first Article 1, Section 1 of our Constitution, and it says, this is the inherent right of the people to govern themselves and to be able to alter, reform, or abolish their government in such a manner as they think applicable. And then you go to the initiative and referendum process, which is in Articles 52, Section, or Article 3, Section 52. That was changed in 1998. We, before that, had an initiative process that was without those two paragraphs. And those two paragraphs were the two-thirds and the 15%. The only thing you need to know about what our founding fathers wanted was that we have an ability as a people to go to our Constitution and do what Section 1, Article 1 said, which is we have a right as a people to go forward and amend our Constitution, and to amend our laws, and to do whatever we see fit as a people. That meant how we elect people. That meant how we bring this body together. It meant how we accessed our laws. It's happened four times. Three of those times, it died. And one time, the legislature actually brought it before the body. It is not an abused right. And so then you get to how do you limit it by the people? And this amendment actually still leaves, I think, a lot of the problem. Instead of having counties, you have Senate districts. I noticed the senator behind me, Senate district, travels around the state so much I'm not even sure I would know where it was. The senator from Senate District 1 reaches into six counties. So you really haven't solved your problem of really concentrating where you have your people. And ultimately, it's still about one man, one vote. And if you get 15% of the people in my county to sign it, you don't have to come ask me. And you've got your people, you're done. And I still don't get an opportunity to be that one person and that one vote. And I don't think our founders and our Constitution meant that. They meant that I have as much of a right to sign that petition as you do. And it doesn't matter where I live. And you cannot say, because the initiative on the railroads and the initiative on the trucks was signed by the people in the southern part of the state, that was wrong. It was an issue that was brought forward by those people, but it still has an incredible hurdle before it can become a law in this state. Remember, it doesn't just count half of the people that vote in, you know, vote 50%, 51%. It has to be voted on by a majority of the people who voted in that election, which means every person that voted had to go into there. And so I think we really do have to talk about, are we the people that are so responsible for this government that we want to tell our citizens, we'll take care of it for you. Never mind. Don't talk to us. Don't bring anything forward on your own. We'll take care of it. And I don't think that's who we are. And I certainly don't think, based on the very first thing in our Constitution, that that's what they meant as well.
Thank you, Senator Mocker. President Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the comments and the wisdom from my colleague here in Laramie County. But sadly enough, and it's great if you live here in Laramie County, because under the system we have right now, if you go down here and stand on the front steps of Walmart, you can collect all the signatures you need. It's doable. And you may have to go to the Walmart perhaps down the tracks a little bit, but you will qualify. You do not need to go out into the Niobrara counties and the Johnson counties. And then you do not need to go up into Warland and places like that. What I'm saying is, if you look at a map, and I'll use here in Laramie County as an example, because of the way the Senate districts are constructed, if you choose to go the route of standing on the steps of Walmart and paying someone to gather signatures, you will be hitting different, diverse senatorial districts. That's the nature of our senatorial districts. By virtue of that, you spread out the influence statewide. Where you choose to collect them is going to still be up to whoever gathers signatures for the initiative. But this says you can't just go to one big box store and collect all the signatures you need. But, Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid I digress a little bit from the amendment which was before us, which is the difference between 15% and 10%. But I did want to address my colleague out of due respect for her wisdom, particularly her constitutional wisdom, which is extraordinary. I still ask you to defeat the amendment.
Thank you, President Schiffer. Senator
Mr. Chairman,
Mockler.
And it is on the amendment, because once you start limiting it to 2/3 of the counties, which obviously I just said I don't like, you've then put a pretty big hurdle. And in Cheyenne, your theory is that you'll be shotgunning if you stand in front of a box store and that you'll meet all 5 Senate districts there. But what you've also got to recognize is that Cheyenne and Laramie County are more than 10% of the people in this state. So why is it that you're telling more than 10% of the people in this state that they aren't equal to the people in a county or in a Senate district? They're not worth the same. You think it's a Senate district, but it's harder to work out than that. And it isn't so. Actually, Cheyenne's probably easier. It's the people that live in Niobrara County, because you aren't going to ever have to touch Niobrara County in order to get those signatures. You can go sit in the other 2 bigger cities in Niobrara County. You can go to Newcastle and start focusing there because of how big those districts are and how disconnected they still are to the people. And that starts saying that I, because they've just shut off how many I need in this district, don't get that say. And at 10%, you're at least giving me a little bit more of a chance to be a little bit more equal in this process.
Thank you, Senator Mockler. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, on and against the amendment, and I'm a little confused. The good senator from Laramie County was saying, yes, she is on the amendment. But looking at the amendment, I heard an argument against the 2/3 provision, but I don't see that in the amendment. All I see in the amendment is dropping the percentage from 15 down to 10%. And I'd say that's, A, it's not a good idea. The idea of the initiative and referendum process was supposed to be difficult. It's supposed to be a grassroots effort for an issue to become so popular or for the legislature's ignorance of that issue to become so popular that it would gain enough momentum throughout the state to get on the ballot. What we saw actually before it was revised by the 2/3, was we saw initiatives being bought. No two ways about it. They were bought. One was bought by one industry, and then the other bought an initiative in reaction to the first one. And we saw that in 1992. That's why we went to the 2/3. We kept the same percentage in there, 15%. That's, I think, the argument we should be having is 10 versus 15%. Mr. Chairman, what we're trying to do is with this bill, with this resolution, constitutional amendment, is to go, get back to the one man, one vote principle to keep in line with the U.S. Constitution. Making it 10 rather than 15% actually is off the reason the bill was formed and was written in the first place.
Thank you, Senator Burns. I think the chair feels that the previous two speakers, one on each side, were really talking about the amendment because, in a way, the spirit of the amendment is the number that's required. I think leeway is required on both sides, if it's okay. Senator Perkins, just a second, let me find you.
I'm right here.
I see you now.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, rising on and against the amendment, I think that the good senator from Cheyenne makes a great point. I mean, the Constitution is, the power is inherent in the people, and we see that in Section 1. And I mean, that's the basis of the U.S. Constitution. That's certainly the basis of the Wyoming Constitution. And I would just bring to the body's attention, when you go to the Section 52 of the Initiative and Referendum, that the 15% was put in by the initiative. There was a joint resolution committee that's then ratified by the citizens of the state. They looked in and they recognized the problems that were with the previous initiative. They recognized the concentration of the power, and they came back and they said 52% in two-thirds of the counties, 15% in two-thirds of the counties. And I think, and quite frankly, I think that's an important statement. The people ratified that and said 15% was the right number in a diverse number of counties. And I would suggest to you that that's what their will is and that we ought to stay with what they wanted.
Thank you, Senator Perkins. Further discussion. Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, I brought this for one reason only. And the reason is the 15%, as far as I'm concerned, is way and above what anyone else in this country expects from their initiative process. And I think it's way and above what our the gentleman who wrote our Constitution and they believed in it. They believed in this process enough to put it in the Constitution where other states let it out. I believe it's too high because it's far and above what anybody else says. And I have to say this, in spite of it, I watched, and I was here when we in '98 with that debacle there, I guess, as some people call it. I'm still here, so I guess I think it's a debacle. It was, but anyway, what I'm saying is, it's too high of a percent, and I am not afraid, and I don't think we should be afraid of citizen participation in our process. I think we should respect that right. And tell them that they have an ability to enter into it without the barrier so high that it's very difficult unless you pay with this process, unless you are able to pay for people to do this. It is a very difficult process for volunteers to do on this basis. And I didn't bring what else we have. But there are several other barriers that we have in this process that really, I feel personally, should not be there for citizen input. So I would urge you to vote yes on this and let it go forward. But I thought we ought to look at this as long as this has come forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Sessions. Are you ready for the question? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, Wyoming has struck a balance between those states that don't allow it at all, and those states that have made the process way too easy. It won't be the first time Wyoming's been different and got it right when the others have got it wrong, and it won't be the last time.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Joint Resolution 1, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The amendment has failed. Division being called, all those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. The amendment has failed. We're back on House Joint Resolution 1. Further discussion? Further discussion? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a due pass recommendation on House Joint Resolution 1, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
House Joint Resolution 1 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is House Bill 44. The reading clerk will please read the file.
House Bill 44, Crime Victims Compensation, sponsored by Representative Berger, an act relating to the Crime Victims Compensation Act. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCarrier, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file or the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 44, Crimes Victims Compensation, and would yield the floor to the floor manager, the good representative from Laramie County, Senator Feck.
Senator Feck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In 1985, the original legislation of 1-40-119 was passed by the legislature, and I believe the theory was that a victim of a crime should not have to financially suffer because they were the victim of that crime. Now, there are two methods to accomplish that. One of them is by direct restitution, and the other is by collecting a fee from all of those who have violated the code and then using the state to disperse that money, and that's exactly what this statute does. In 1997, the original legislation was modified, and at that time, $50 was the fee for anything that any violation of a municipal ordinance, and $100 was the fee for any crime enumerated in our current Wyoming statute 61101 through 610, which is the general criminal procedure, and a few other crimes also. That fee has not been changed since 1997. So we're now 11 years later, and the problem that the division now has is that they're paying out $149,000 a month, and they're not collecting that much. They're collecting about $139,000. They are also collecting some fees from the federal government, but it appears to them that those are going to soon disappear. So they've asked that we consider raising those fee amounts. And if you look at your bill, page 2, line 5, the $50 minimum for the municipal violations goes to $100, and the $100 minimum for all other crimes goes to $150. Both of those now have new language added to them, and the new language establishes a cap. That establishment of a cap is a direct recommendation from the LSO based on interpretations of Supreme Court cases in our state. The other change that this bill proposes is down on lines 12 through 15, that on subsequent offenses, the minimum is $200 and the maximum be $400. So I ask for your favorable consideration on this bill. There are no amendments that I know of, and I would stand for questions.
Questions for the good senator. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I do have a question, and that is ultimately this. As I understand the surcharge in these, this is not to be punitive. Those would be fines, but these are simply these are dollars that are assessed on a surcharge that would go into the victim's compensation fund. And I understand that there's certain things that are in the victim's compensation fund that they reimburse victims for, which is a very laudable and appropriate that be done. And I guess my question is when we do this, why are we just assessing this amount instead of looking at what it takes to make that fund just solvent and accomplish the duties that it has? Why aren't we looking at that and determining what those demands are and then assess fees appropriate to that, whether it's in a range or whatever it is, instead of just saying, okay, now we're just going to double the fees because, oh, by golly, that ought to suffice. And ultimately, this has a specific purpose, It ends up being a non-appropriation, I believe. And so ultimately, I'm just wondering, this seems kind of like a seat of the pants kind of a thing, and it seems like it'd have more thought than that.
Thank you, Senator Perkins. Senator Feck. Just a second. I'm trying to get you on, Senator Peck. Hold on a second. You know, sometimes it just doesn't go green. Try your mic, would you please? Can you? I broke it.
That's right. I don't.
There, now you're on. Thank you. Thank you, Chief Clerk. You're on now.
Thank you. The good senator is correct. It is not a punitive fee that's been charged. I believe that they did do some mathematical calculations to arrive at an amount, but I will verify that and let you know, assuming this passes and we have a chance to do so at second reading. I don't know that for a fact.
Thank you, Senator Feck. Senator Nicholas.
I guess, you know, and along a different line, when we start looking at doubling these fines to the $100, and I don't have the list in front of me, I'm just looking at it on my screen here, but the far majority of the types of items that are going to be collected, I think, from municipal courts are things where the fines are only about $50 to begin with. I think, and I may be wrong, but there are things like MIPs, things that really are pretty victimless crimes. And so the vast majority of these, you're doubling and tripling fines for youngsters, young people. And then for the folks that are, you know, and I understand doubling for felonies, for high misdemeanors, things like that. But it does occur to me that it's an awfully big jump for a lot of offenses that you would never expect to pay $200 or $100 for crime victims. And so all of a sudden now you're looking at what the fund would like to spend. And the fund has a substantial budget and there's a substantial demand on it. But now you're looking at the demand of the fund instead of looking at who should really be paying this and whether some of these smaller offenses should really warrant this size of an increase. But I assume that by volume, a lot of the real victimless stuff are the largest ones. That's where you're collecting all your money. And there's fewer of the crimes that really have victims involved. And you're actually then generating all the revenues from that large group.
Should we do Senator Scott and then Senator Effect, if you can handle two in a row? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, previous speaker raised an issue that I think the way he raised it brings my concern to the forefront. He spoke of these things as fines. And that's really what they are. Now, this is different from court costs that are charged partly to defray the operation of the court system. These are penalties we've put in, fines, if you will, to fund a different program. And let me read Article 7, Section 5. All fines and penalties under general laws of the state shall belong to the public school fund of the respective counties and be paid over to the custodians of such funds for current support of the public schools therein. That was put in the Constitution so that you would avoid this sort of business of fines being used and generated to support specific state operations and give an incentive to have more fines. And it's one we've been pretty strict about enforcing. And I have never understood how, under our Constitution, we can take these fees. They may be not called a fine, but the language of the Constitution is fines and penalties, and they're sure as heck penalties. They're not fines. I've never understood how we can take these fees and put them into the crime victims' compensation fund in the first place.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm having trouble again, Senator Massey. I'm sorry.
Bet you folks can hear me.
I don't know if the folks on the internet can hear you, though. Got to have a magic touch, but it takes about five times. You're on now, Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, it is a surcharge, and it specifically says a surcharge in legislation that was established over 20 years ago and has been amended six or seven times since then. And I, as far as I know of, nobody has questioned the constitutionality of this surcharge for a program that is extremely valuable in this state. And it is important that we keep it solvent. In the past, there's been a great deal of debate here on this floor about whether or not we should allow any agency an open-ended ability to set whatever rates they want in order to fill a fund and cover costs, or whether we jealously guard our ability to do that in legislation. And 9 out of 10 times, we come down on the side of setting it in legislation, whether it's game and fish fees or other types of fees in state government, including this one right here. So I think that the question isn't whether or not this is constitutional. I believe that it is. I don't believe that the question is whether or not this is worthwhile. We've been doing it for over 20 years, and the purposes have been demonstrated to be worthwhile. I think the question is whether or not we want to set the fees at $100 and $300 and elsewhere here in the legislation in order to keep this very valuable program solvent.
Thank you, Senator Massey. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd point out that for almost 15 years, our statutes provided that the surcharges, penalties, civil penalties that were assessed by DEQ would be paid to DEQ, and they used those for their various funds. When this issue was raised within the last year and a half, the Attorney General looked at it after 15 years of statutes rolling in and determined, in fact, they are civil penalties, and under the Constitution, the dollars go to the school foundation, or to the schools. And right now, the DEQ has lost a source of revenue. Of course, they've done fine. They're still going on. But they lost a source of revenue for remediation projects that they've been spending for, well, probably since 1973 when the act was passed. So it is appropriate to look at these things. And brings about the whole analysis of whether it's wrong or right, what's in the statute, to perpetuate it and decrease the amount just makes it worse.
Thank you, Senator Nicholas. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think that I can address the constitutional issue, but I did want to address one issue that was raised by the good senator from Albany County with regard to such offenses as MIPs or status offenses and so forth. And I think you really have to go back and you have to look at the language in 140.119 and the Romanets below that. When you're talking about violations in municipal court, which would incur this surcharge, you're looking at violations of a municipal ordinance which is substantially similar, has substantially similar elements to criminal offenses specified in paragraphs Romanet 2 through 4, and that's your criminal code under Title 6. And then it goes on to indicate that or a municipal ordinance which causes actual damage to persons or property. So I don't think that there's a surcharge on MIP sorts of situations, but it does make reference to DUIs in one of the references, and that's where you see a lot of those. But I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Senator Ross. Senator Feck.
Mr. Chairman, I would follow up a little bit on that comment. The actual charges referenced by the state statute are eluding a police officer, DUI, reckless driving, possession of a controlled substance, soliciting, and immoral acts. So none of those are low-level, minor-in-possession type MIPs. I would also say that this issue of compensation has been addressed by the Supreme Court in at least two court cases that I have the information on, three court cases. And in two of those, one was a $1,500 imposition of a surcharge. That $1,500 surcharge was upheld by the Supreme Court for the state of Wyoming. And there was another one where it was a $2,000 surcharge. That was also upheld by the Supreme Court as being a reasonable and justified fee or surcharge.
Thank you, Senator Feck. Further discussion on the file? Further discussion? Ready for the question. All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the due pass recommendation on House Bill 44, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 44 has passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Ross, could I get you to take the chair?
The next Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 109. The reading clerk will please read it. Our House Bill 109.
House Bill 109, Telecommunications Switched Access, sponsored by Representative Illaway, an act relating to telecommunications. It was referred to committee number nine, or to committee number seven, Corporations, Elections, Political Subdivisions, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, DeCarrier, and Larson. No, Senators Cooper and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Case?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 109. There is a standing committee amendment, and I would request it be read in at this time.
House Bill 109, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 1, line 1.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the standing committee amendment to House Bill 109. Mr. Chairman. About a year ago, we spent a lot of time on a new Telecommunications Act for the state of Wyoming. It replaced the law that we developed and implemented in 1995. There hasn't been too much action on that act, Mr. Chairman, but there has been one decision, and the decision indicates that we're not very clear with something I thought that we were very clear about. The area that it appears that we are not clear is the language in 3715203, little section E. Mr. Chairman, 3715203, and I know you don't want to have the full-blown review of what we did last year, but there were kind of two things that were going on. One was that in a section called 202 that we had a lot of discussion of was how companies could get their specific rates and services declared competitive. Then there was a section called 203, and in 203 was how companies could get their rates changed for services that aren't competitive. There was a variety of menus provided in section 203 depending on the type of service and the circumstance. A question has come up, I think if you will recall, and by the way, I had caused to be passed out, Mr. Chairman, a handout with a copy of the statute, 3715203, with all the various sections where you can file your rates. The only ones that seem to be in question here have to do with switched access, and that's what this bill is about, Mr. Chairman. And the sections that we'll be talking about are E, which I've indicated with a box on the handout. We'll probably talk a little bit about F, which carries on to the next page, and we'll talk a little bit about J, which is at the bottom of the second page and carries on. The nutshell of all these is they have different purposes. E, let's start with F, Mr. Chairman. It's not in the bill, but it's certainly relevant to the discussion. As you recall, we had a long discussion about switched access and the fact that in some parts of Wyoming, switched access continue to remain persistently high. And switched access is what a telephone company, a local exchange telephone company, charges another company, a long-distance company, to interconnect and bring calls into their service territory or pick calls up. The most important thing about switched access is that's one of the services that a telephone company supplies that's not paid for by the customers of that telephone company. Switched access is paid for by the customers of another telephone company, a long-distance company. And we were very, very careful. We talked about switched access a lot. We were very careful about what we did with switched access. And, in fact, we said in the area of 202, where you can come in and ask for something to be declared competitive, we said, you can't make this competitive. We said that in 202. In 203, we made a special arrangement in F for those companies that had very high rates. We gave them a transition period to get their rates down over time. We went farther than that, and we said, not only do we want you to get them down, but we're willing to let you use the Universal Service Fund to offset the charges that you make as we get those rates down. That's what F is all about. If you look in F, it's all about reducing access charges, and it says you've got to get them down by a particular time. You've got to get them down to 3 cents. And it also says if you have a special arrangement and you need help, you can file a cost study and get an extension for 2 years. That's what F does. Gets them down to 3 cents. I said F. I meant J. Everything I've said so far is about Section J. Then there's a part in E. E is the crux of the matter in this bill, and it's a part that's been misinterpreted. E says a local exchange company may seek approval to make revenue-neutral adjustments, considering only revenue from non-competitive essential telecommunications services, and I'm going to skip a little bit, to reduce or eliminate differences in the price of non-competitive essential telecommunications services in different portions of its service area. Mr. Chairman, this is about a company, we were very specific about that, that has differences in price across its area, and it wants to rebalance prices solely within its own customer base. That's what E is for. Now, a filing has been made, and the Commission has made a mistake. They have used E to allow a company to raise switched access and lower local exchange rates. It's problematic, and seriously problematic, Mr. Chairman, partly because switched access doesn't vary across the exchange or the territory. It's the same price. So clearly, switched access can't be used here. But it was done. Mr. Chairman, it's also problematic because switched access is paid by other people's customers, other customers in the state of Wyoming. That's the biggest rub of all. Because if we allow this mistake to continue, then E will permit companies to lower their rates, raise their switched access, and shift the burden onto other people's customers. So that if you have a particular company, you can make all your customers happy by lowering rates and stick it to everyone else who will pay for that increase. Now, look, we never said you couldn't raise or move switch access. We just said you couldn't do it in E. Because E is so important, it has to be a balancing within your own customer base and for things that vary across your own geography. The place that you can raise switched access rates is F. And F just has a little bit higher of a standard. It says a local exchange company may seek approval to increase your price of a non-competitive essential telecommunications services based on changes in the local calling area, changes in access charges, if access charges are part of your service, other changes affecting non-competitive essential telecommunications services, or the next one is some kind of increase in cost. You're welcome. You're not prohibited from increasing your access charges. Just bring it in under F. We gave them the remedy. And it's an important remedy because you need the extra scrutiny because when you raise switched access rates, you're not affecting your own customer. That's what this bill does, Mr. Chairman, is to go into E and say you can't use it to raise switched access rates. And the amendment tries to take crystal clear and make it Tiffany crystal clear, Mr. Chairman, by saying in F, putting a flashing light that says, a local exchange company may seek approval to increase the price of non-competitive essential telecommunications services in the amendment, including switched access, based on these factors. That's the amendment. We can discuss the amendment and then the bill as well, Mr. Chairman.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just a moment. Got to figure the computer. There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the good senator from Lander has said that the Public Service Commission has made a mistake, that they didn't know what we were doing. Well, Mr. Chairman, I certainly knew what I was doing last year, and I can say unequivocally that the Public Service Commission did not make a mistake. They looked at our statute. They looked at our statute in totality. They made a decision based on what was fair to all the customers of Wyoming. They have to include all of the customers. They cannot make a decision. That's one of the bases that they make all of their decisions with. The company in question did do a rebalancing within their district. They rebalanced from an area where they had almost a $100 rate down to a $50 rate. That was one rebalance. That rate rebalance helped every one of you in your universal service funds. So you don't have to pay as much for your universal service funds. True that when you call somebody in that particular area, you may have to or may not have to call, pay more for long distance. It may be absorbed by the good companies outside in the lobby. They may have to pay more in their rates, and they may absorb that because of some of the calling plans that they have. We did look at it, and the Public Service Commission looked at it, and they said that we have a 3% cap in this legislation. And they did say that you can rate rebalance, and that authorization is not only in E, but it is also in G, which is not mentioned on the floor. Let me read G. And G says, any requested price change under subsections B through F of this section, E is between B and F, including revenue-neutral changes that may result in an increase in the price of non-competitive essential telecommunication services, is subject to review and determination of the commission after notice and opportunity for hearing. The company noticed. They went to the Public Service Commission for hearing. They went to E, which was non-price of a non-competitive essential telecommunication services. And it says in E that, yes, you can rebalance for non-competitive and get a price increase on non-competitive essential telecommunication services. And so if you read the whole statute in its totality, the Public Service Commission was right on point. Right on point. Now let's look at what this bill does and what this amendment further clarifies. Mr. Chairman, this is price fixing. This amendment fixes a price, and it's doing it at the cost of some companies and rewarding the companies that are right outside in the lobby. That's the companies that get the benefit by passing this, not the consumers in Wyoming, because when the prices go down, the need for a universal service fund goes down. That 3 cents was not arbitrary. We looked at it during the process, and 3 cents a minute will bring most people up to where they do not need to charge local line access rates above the 130% of the statewide average for universal service funds. That's not an arbitrary number. Mr. Chairman, the repercussions are waves of the unintended and intended consequences will be felt by every telephone line subscriber in Wyoming. This price-fixing scheme guarantees low prices to the Wyoming-based to non-Wyoming-based telecommunications companies
but does not provide a guarantee that these same companies will not raise their prices to Wyoming customers. In fact, Mr. Chairman, we cannot guarantee, because the Wyoming Public Service Commission has no authority to regulate them, and we have no authority to pass laws against that, against them not raising their prices. So we're saying fix the prices, make sure that we have to pay high universal service funds. Mr. Chairman, you know, to really fully understand this price-fixing scheme, you must know about some other billing schemes. And these things are clear outside the conversation probably on this floor and outside of the understanding of a lot of folks. But it's one of the billing schemes is where they're headed. It's called bill and keep. And I'll tell you, only the only place I've seen this is when I'm on my cell phone and I'm driving through someplace and I get my cell phone call and bill the next month. And I see this little thing for 70 or 80 cents a minute for roaming charges. That's bill and keep, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. So that's the tip of the iceberg on that one. You also have to know a little bit about the Missoula plan or comparable plans, and that's a nationwide plan to basically fix prices for everything on interconnection agreements and a whole lot of other things, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this is a complicated issue. It's not appropriate for a budget session. It's price fixing. And price fixing, Mr. Chairman, it's just wrong.
Further discussion on the amendment. I got to find you, Senator. Here you go.
I was going to say it's an American, but.
Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on the amendment, and I won't pretend to match the expertise of either the former chairman, I was chairman of Corporations Committee when the legislation here was developed in the joint interim, or that is the senator from Goshen County, or the senator from Fremont County is the current chairman of the Corporations Committee. I'm just, as Corporations Committee chairman goes, I'm just an ancient has-been. But I did chair that committee for a while. Mr. Chairman, during the joint interim in 2006, we heard extensive testimony on this issue. And the testimony was that you've got two problems with these switched access charges. If you get them too high, then what happens is you run, and there is a rebalancing involved here, you run your cost to the local subscriber costs down at the expense of everybody else. If you get them too low, you run your cost to the local subscriber way high, and you hit the universal service fund, and you drain that. So you need, it's a balancing act. Now, what the amendment does that we're discussing, Mr. Chairman, is that it goes in to subsection F and says a local carrier may seek approval, increase in the price of non-competitive essential communication services, and says including switched access charges. Mr. Chairman, I would represent to the Senate that that amendment to this bill doesn't do any good. And it doesn't really do any harm. I think it doesn't change the existing law in the slightest. Because the switched access charge is a non-competitive service, they can use the subsection F, and it was put in there, and I can tell you because I had a hand in putting it in there. It was put in there so because if you don't have a mechanism for increasing the prices as the costs go up, you run risks of an unconstitutional takings. And some, there's been regulations in other states, particularly California, that have run afoul of that and been thrown out. So vote this particular amendment up or vote it down, you aren't going to do any harm or any good no matter which way you vote.
Further discussion on the amendment. Senator Case.
On the amendment, I think I agree with the tall senator. The only point I would make is because access charges are used in too little I, there's been some, it has been argued because we use the access charges in the subsection too little I, that indeed they can apply to the main section F, and clearly that's what we meant. I totally agree with the tall senator and urge your adoption. Then we can have a debate about the rest of the issues brought up by the good senator for Goshen County, which I think are really on the bill itself.
Any further discussion on the amendment? You ready for the question? All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. There is a Committee of the Whole amendment. We might as well take that up at this time. Senator Scott.
I'm going to read it in.
Mr. Chairman, let me read. Have it read.
Please have it read in.
House Bill 109, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 2, line 7.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of this amendment. Mr. Chairman, on the face of it, this amendment is pretty plain vanilla. It substitutes the July 1 effective date for the immediate effective date, you know, going to the standard effective date that we frequently use. Mr. Chairman, it does have a practical implication in this case. Mr. Chairman, as you heard, this bill was occasioned by a Public Service Commission decision that some senators did not, or some legislators did not agree with. And so they brought a bill to tell the Public Service Commission you were wrong. And my understanding is that the technicalities of that decision are such that it's still in the formal processes. It's known, it's been, but not all the paperwork has been properly signed off on. And I think, Mr. Chairman, with an immediate effective date, there is a risk we will overturn that specific decision applying to a specific company that was, frankly, the outlier on the low side on switched access charges. And, Mr. Chairman, I think that's wholly inappropriate for the legislature to come in and do that sort of thing. You put a July 1 effective date on it, that decision will have gone through all the normal processes and be final, and you won't affect it. I don't think you're opening it up to other mischief by going to a July 1 effective date, because these things take a long time. I don't know of any other cases that are in the pipeline on this particular issue. And so you'll have a general law going forward that will apply to any new cases. And I will tell you that you don't have problems on the downside with bad outliers. So I think if we adopt this amendment, we'll avoid the mischief of overturning a specific case involving a specific company that has been heard by the Public Service Commission, and where a decision is known, even though the paperwork isn't final. I'd urge adoption of the amendment.
Further discussion on the amendment. Senator Case.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This amendment delays the effective date, which I believe would continue to have the mischief that we need to talk about in terms of the bad consequences that could come about. So I would like leeway from the chair to talk about some of those consequences as well, because the issue is here, what could happen if we delay the effective date? I think a better approach, if you want to make sure that this one case that I think is closed, but if it can be argued that it could be impacted by this decision, I think we should bring an amendment that says this legislation shall not affect cases begun and pending before the Public Service Commission or something like that, and still have an effective immediate date. Otherwise, you have this window. And what can happen in that window? I think we have to talk about the merits of the bill, Mr. Chairman, and back to the language. And it was referenced by the good senator from Goshen County when we talk about Section E. E is what the ruling was based on. But E clearly says, and we wrote it to mean, that they can use this rebalancing to reduce or eliminate differences in the price of non-competitive essential telecommunications services in different portions of its service area. Switched access does not vary across the service territory. That's the plain and simple truth of it. Switched access cannot be used under E. And we did provide a remedy. Every single company has a remedy to deal with switch access under F. Even though we added those words just now, we all agree it did exist under F. The question was, has been raised, that the 3 cents is a policy decision that we made to raise up to 3 cents and to lower the others down to 3 cents, and there would be balance there. Not true. There are no facts in the record of any deliberations of the interim committee under for the time period. And I did cause to be handed out, Mr. Chairman, an amendment. It's House Bill 109 case, and it says it has an organization's name, and it says amendments to LSO 64W3. And you can see a bunch of amendments, some of which, these are from the official file on the legislation, some of which were passed, all of which were offered. And I underlined it right here at the bottom of the first page, where you can see that an amendment was offered to do exactly what happened in this case, to raise intrastate access charges up to 3 cents. And that amendment was not accepted by the committee, was never part of any of the proposed bills. I speak against the amendment and for the bill.
Further discussion on the amendment? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this is almost like arguing in front of the Public Service Commission. And, Mr. Chairman, this is why I think we really need to probably pass this particular amendment at the very least, and probably kill the bill, because, Mr. Chairman, this is extremely complicated stuff we're talking about here. Now, non-competitive essential telecommunication services, that also includes, Mr. Chairman, the rates that are charged for your different lines. That's basically your basic telephone rate, because that's non-competitive in this area. And so they had two non-competitive essential telecommunication service elements. They took one element, it went up with that, they took the other element, and they went down with it, and they rebalanced. Perfectly acceptable under E. The standard was the Public Service Commission said that it couldn't hurt the customers of Wyoming, and it didn't, because everything's rebalanced. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't think we need to get into a Public Service Commission argument. I think we need to vote for this amendment and then vote the bill down.
Further discussion on the amendment. Senator Case.
Chairman, we've also thought ahead about how we help customers in Wyoming. We thought how we want this to be handled. We deliberately decided we did not want high access charges that were hidden. And people didn't know about them. Hidden charges on your bills. Implicit subsidies. We said, it's a tough thing to do, but we're going to have explicit subsidies. We created the Universal Service Fund. We provided a mechanism for solving these problems and dealing with them on an open basis. And, Mr. Chairman, we must reject the notion that somehow we're putting it to customers in other states or companies in other states. We are raising rates to all long-distance customers in Wyoming to subsidize local exchange service. We're creating that. An implicit subsidy to do that, one that people won't see on their bill, except for the final tally, when we have a mechanism that we created, the Universal Service Fund, which was meant to make it transparent and above board. There are long-distance companies based in Wyoming that will pay these fees. There are local exchange companies that also have long-distance companies that will pay these fees. And it doesn't matter what company you are, your long-distance rates will go up in a hidden tax to do these fees. When we have all along said, boy, we need to make this explicit and make it with the Universal Service Fund.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're on the amendment, and a point of order. I would hope we could stay on the amendment.
Sure. Further discussion on the amendment, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification. In 2007, we took the cross subsidies the prohibition of, against cross subsidies off, and we went to a more. And so, you know, you take the cross subsidies off. What does that mean? You can have implicit subsidization within your system.
Further discussion on the amendment, Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the amendment, I see no way, whether we pass the bill or not, it's going to affect the PSC decision. It has been voted on, and I may add, I was told by the chairman of the commission, it is a split decision that's been voted on, because they couldn't decide exactly what, if you would, we meant in the process. My fear is if you delay that, there is a possibility that other decisions could be filed and come up, and they once again will not know what our intent was. It has been voted on. The vote's been taken. It's just waiting to be published. And so let's give them guidance as to whichever way you want to vote on the bill, but let's give them guidance as we go forward of exactly what we did intend, so that we don't get more split decisions on a very complicated issue between now and the enactment date. So I would ask you to, how you vote on the bill, I don't know, but reject the amendment so at least we have clear guidance to the Public Service Commission from this point forward of what our intention was.
Further discussion, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman. On and for the amendment, Mr. Chairman, I think, having listened to a number of the interested parties talk, I think there's a risk with the immediate effective date that we're attacking a specific decision on relating to a specific company on which PSC has made a decision but hasn't got it finalized yet because of the paperwork. This will prevent that particular mischief. Mr. Chairman, their process is so slow that by the time there's any possibility, they'll hit another case between now and 1st of July, so that the new law would be in effect when any other cases come up. So I don't think we run any risks that way. So I urge us to adopt the amendment.
Further discussion. You ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
That amendment has failed. We're back on the bill. Any further discussion on House Bill 109? Right. Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't mean to belabor, and I certainly don't want to get in the way of my two colleagues at the back of the room because they know far more than I, but I suspect that I'm not the only one in the room who could use a little bit of clarification, and I guess this would be to the sponsor of the bill. Just so that I can understand, if we do not adopt this language, a company in your hometown can lower the rate. The Universal Fund will reimburse them, so your customers may not even see the difference. But the rate that they've lowered, the people in my district will have to pick up the slack on that. I guess that's one question. And I guess the second part of the question is, if that is indeed the case where one company can lower their rates in a given area and all of the rest of us pick up that rate, was that really the intent of what this chamber did a year and 2 years ago? That would just help me to make my decision on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the specifics of the question of the company in my town and the company in your town, I think we may have the same company, so maybe it doesn't impact you and me, but on a more general question that you ask at the end, if you have one company in your town and they decide to lower their rates and increase the switch access charge to make it up, it actually doesn't affect the Universal Service Fund. In fact, that doesn't come into play because they're getting the revenue from the switched access. But that switched access, and you're exactly right, is paid by the customers in your town, in your town, in your town, in your town. And that's not what we intended. And that's not right. That's why we created the Universal Service Fund. That's why we tried to get these access charges lowered. And that's why we set an E already, not vary by geography. Thank you.
Further discussion, Senator Cooper.
Thank you. Am I on? Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As was pointed out earlier, you know, this bill is very, very serious business, as you can tell from the discussion that's been going on here today and the complicity of the statutes have to do with. I got on that committee later in the process when this was all coming about last year when we were doing the new additions and changes to the Telecommunications Act. And so it's been a real struggle even for me, which is probably not new to you guys, that took a little bit of a lot of reading and a lot of study to even get up to speed with it. But, you know, this is a testimony as I heard it in the committee. First of all, if you are from an area that has some fairly small telecom providers, it really, this bill really does affect them pretty seriously. If you come from an area in the state where probably the single largest provider of telecommunication service, I won't give any names, you know who they are, they have a neutral position on this bill. So it probably doesn't affect you a whole lot as far as your local rates go. However, I guess the ones that were the most outspoken in the committee meeting when we listened to them were the large long-distance carriers who come in either from outside the state or other states, whatever, and bring in the telecommunications, long-distance telecommunications services that we have in our communities. That's the way I recall it. And so it mostly affects, as it appears to me, to get it right down on the most basic level, as I can get it to, and maybe some of the other committee members heard it differently, but that's the providers that it affects the most, is those long-distance carriers, because those switching rates in those little communities will change, okay? Access switching for long distance. And Mr. Chairman, that's the way I heard it, and because of that, I am opposed to this bill.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I think the question from my colleague from Natrona County is the beginning of wisdom on this. This really, it's a balancing. And if you go to either extreme, it's likely to hit your constituents with higher fees, higher costs. If the switched access charge is unreasonably high, then what happens is the long distance rates for everybody goes up, and that charge and that cost is used to run the local cost down, that revenue. And you've had some cases where you've got firms that have had very low local costs compared to what the rest of us face. If, on the other hand, the charge is abnormally low, then the local charge goes way up, and it can go up either across the whole of the service area or in just parts of it. It depends on how the companies look at their costs, how they structure their rates. But it can go very high. When it goes very high, you get over 130% of the statewide average. You hit the Universal Service Fund. And when you hit the state Universal Service Fund, that comes back directly in a higher charge that your customers pay. If you are in some kind of a broad middle band on this issue, then you don't have the excessive lowering of the local charge, you don't have the excessive charging the long distance customers, and you don't have the abuse of the higher Universal Service Fund that comes with the extra low charge. And what it amounts to, Mr. Chairman, is that you've got one set of costs that are incurred in the telephone business that are overwhelming, and if you don't incur those costs, you can't provide any other services. You can't provide, you don't have the wire and the switches in the ground that get you the dial tone. You can't provide any other service. And where we're going, as you hit a middle ground, is a reasonable distribution of those costs between the long-distance usage and the local charge. And it is, Mr. Chairman, a balancing. So I think it's inappropriate to try to unbalance it, and that's one of the reasons I am opposed to this bill. The other reason is you're dealing in a very highly technical area. The Public Service Commission held lengthy hearings, heard from all the parties, and made a decision. And I think it's a mistake to bring a bill to overturn a specific decision of a regulatory commission like that. I think we ought to have some confidence in what they're doing. And I think that for that reason, this bill ought to go down.
Further discussion on House Bill. Senator DeCaria.
I don't think it was totally accurate. It was just small company. It was just going to hurt small companies. One of the most vocal opponents of vocal proponents of this piece of legislation was from a small company, and saying that they really did resent the fact that we were going to cost shift these costs onto their customers, and there's nothing they could do about it. According to the PSC, the Public Service Commission, currently these charges now added about a dollar to most people's bill. Okay, if we're going to talk about most people probably are on a major carrier in the state, and I think that's probably true just because that's where the people live. If we allow this to go up, they had an estimate that that dollar charge could go to $2. Now, that may not be a lot, but the thing, Mr. Chairman, that I resent is the fact that it's kind of a hidden charge. It comes in through the back door. I know the Universal Service Fund. I see that on my bill. You know I'm subsidizing phone customers in certain parts of the state. You know? Not that I'm 100% on board with that. I understand that there's some places where that needs to go. But I think it's a dangerous avenue we walk down when we start putting those charges hidden into the bill. And make no mistake, your bill will go up, but that charge will be hidden in other fees, but the net result will be an increase because of those customers being able to lower their phone bills. Other customers' phone bills will go up.
Further discussion, Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, I want to be brief. There was something that was passed out. I'm assuming everybody's got lobbied on this little piece of paper here. I wanted to touch on a few of those. Yes, there was a recent ruling. We talked about the standard in which the Public Service Commission applied that, that it was fair to all the customers in Wyoming. The Public Service Commission made that determination. It goes on to say what House Bill 109 does. It price fixes and makes sure that the long-distance companies are going to have the same price. Does not guarantee that you're going to get any lower price, just guarantees they're going to have the same price. Doesn't guarantee your prices are going to go up. You probably will have the same calling package that you've always had. Does not do it. Says that you can that telephone companies can go and get a rate rebalancing in front of the Public Service Commission if it can show it's justified. They have to use a total service long-run incremental cost study. That's why some small companies don't want it. It'll cost them over $100,000 to do that. The cost shifting that has been talked about and the internal cost shifting that's in the bills, basically the Public Service Commission has made, I think, the correct calling on this, that we've left it up to them to determine what those access rates should be. And they've pretty much said it's not going to be over 3 cents a minute. They've determined that that's a reasonable price. then they're not going to make a decision that's going to harm any customers. So I think we've put it in the hands of the Public Service Commission. I don't believe they did make a mistake in how the statutes were interpreted. I knew exactly what they said, and I was very happy with that part of the bill when it left. We don't have we've taken out the prohibition about cost shifting. That's something we said we want to deregulate, and now we want to re-regulate with this. You're either, I guess, pro price fixing or you're pro deregulation.
Further discussion, Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I promise this will be the last time if you'll just let her go. Just want to correct some statements. Switch to Access, the most special service, because it's paid by other people's customers. That's why it's restricted in 202. But there's no way it can be competitive, and that's why we made special arrangements in 203. It's not price fixing. It is not price fixing at all. There was not in any piece of legislation that ever came through here that this rate was supposed to raise and use that 3% area. There was an amendment proposed. It died. Never made it in any bill. Mr. Chairman, we provide a fair and reasonable way for companies to increase switched access. They're not denied a remedy. They can bring it under F. F does not require a total service long-run incremental cost. It does not require that. The only place a total service long-run incremental cost is required is in J, and that is for companies that after 2015, and I may be slightly wrong on the date, still have not been able to get their switched access charges down to 3 cents. If that is true, and there's a handful of companies that are out there higher, then they can use a total service incremental cost to keep them up higher. But F does not require a total service long-run incremental cost study, not price fixing, and switched access is special. That's why we put it in both sections of the law. Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? Ready for the question on the bill. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report to do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 109, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
House Bill 109 has passed Committee of the Whole. Division has been called for. All those in favor of House Bill 109, please stand. Those opposed? House Bill 109 has passed Committee of the Whole.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 134. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 134, School District's Immunity and Liability Insurance, sponsored by Representative Stubson, an act relating to school districts. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, Cole, Jennings, Massey, Von Flakren, Senator Cole, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the file. What is your pleasure, Senator Cole?
Moving the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with the due pass recommendation on House Bill 134 and defer to Senator Massey for an explanation of the House bill.
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill is essentially on page 2. The deleted language eliminates the present provisions for school districts with regard to insuring themselves against personal injury loss and replaces that language with including them in the state's public sector provisions with regard to personal injury loss. The deleted sections were written in 1957 and 1969, essentially direct school districts to come up with their own insurance policies against financial loss arising out of any claim, demand, or judgment for personal injury. It's created a great deal of confusion, and for some of the smaller school districts, it's been very difficult to get this type of insurance. So the bill deletes those provisions, and in the new language down on lines 13 through 15, as well as with the repealers in Section 2, what it effectively does is applies the approach that the public sector takes in Wyoming with regard to state government, local government, special districts, and essentially says that the school districts will be liable for any personal injury up to $250,000 and that they need to have insurance to cover it up to that particular point, and that anything above $250,000, just like state government and other public entities, that there's an immunity. The provisions in lines 13 through 15 indicate that the school districts can self-insure for that amount if that's in their financial interest, or join with other school districts to do that. Be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Massey. Questions for Senator Massey? Questions? I don't think we have any questions. Let's move to the bill. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 134, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 134 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next House bill for our consideration is House Bill 98. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 98, Speech Pathologist Licensing, and sponsored by Representative Ken Escobel, an act relating to professions and occupations. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Ullman, Feck, Hastert, Landon, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 98 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment, and I ask it be read in at this time.
House Bill 98, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 3, line 14.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, Standing Committee Amendment does two things. The page 4, line 14 reference is a grammatical correction that was brought to us by the LSO. The other item, and I'm afraid I'll have to get into a little bit of what the bill's about, what's going on is nationally the audiologists are going to a doctorate degree standard, and this bill reflects that national movement. What we did in committee was we said that we modified the language that provides that we're going to possess at least a doctor in audiology to say, or a master's degree in audiology or equivalent, granted before July 1, 2012, the proponents of the bill that were present thought that was a good idea. And the practical effect is that if we develop a shortage of audiologists, which now apparently we don't have, this will enable us to recruit and bring in new audiologists from elsewhere that we otherwise would be precluded from reaching because they're people that have gotten a master's degree back in the days when the master's degree was still available. That's what the Standing Committee Amendment does. It does loosen up this fence a little bit, and I would urge adoption of it and be happy to answer any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Questions on the Standing Committee Amendment? Any questions? Ready for the question. All those in favor of the Senate Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 98, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Back on the bill, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I yield to Senator Von Flatern for an explanation of this good little House bill.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're on a roll now, fellow senators. This bill is very simple. It's just an update. I always start out with that one. It's an update that takes in audiologists and speech pathologists and updates their standards. It also brings us into the modern age when you can talk about, do I dare say the word telecommunications? But anyway, that's included on page 2, the very top, 3333-103, where things like telephonics, electronics, or other means are included. There is a handout on your desk that really explains this bill probably better than I. There's a repealer in there that eliminates people from not in Wyoming to be coming across. As long as the old regulations were in effect, they could serve this place, they could come across without the same standards that we impose on our own and serve their customers twice a month as long as they did it no more than twice in 30 days. There's 15 states that are currently requiring these standards, and that's where audiology goes into having to have a doctor's doctorate to be able to practice here. And as the good senator from Natrona said, we allowed a loophole, and for those that are still working on their master's or have their master's prior to that date in the amendment, they still will be able to practice and not be forced suddenly to go get their doctorate before they can practice. And then there's a repealer again about when they talk about master's degree versus getting a doctorate. And then there's a place in there for clinical. So if you graduate with your master's in audiology and then you need to do a clinical, there's a process in there under 3333306, bottom of page, bottom of, I'm sorry, 3333104. Oh, I'm sorry, it's bottom page 3, where you can get a 12-month provisional license to work on your doctorate and up to 12 months more extension in order to finish that. So really, this is just an update of their standards, bringing in line with what is going on in most states at the moment and making sure that all practicing audiologists and pathologists, speech pathologists in our state are all on the same page and have the same requirements to practice. And I ask you a favorable vote on this bill.
Thank you, Senator Von Fleitern. Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we have to be very careful here, and I have a question for the sponsor of the bill. And one of the things, and I understand getting the additional education requirements, but what about, and I particularly have an email from a lady in my district. She's been practicing this for 30 years. She's certified by the professional teacher standard. She's been in our school system all that long, doing a good job, but she does not have a master's degree. She's been competent. She's passed all of the, updates, the requirements, done the CLEs, everything necessary. But as I understand it, if we pass this bill, then she will be without her job, and the school district will be looking at hiring someone with a master's degree and no experience. You know, in a state like Wyoming where, we have a lot of problems finding good people, here we have a really qualified lady that's doing a good job, but she does not have a master's degree. So are we going to tell her she can't do it when we may not be able to find someone that can even do it?
Thank you, Senator Bebout. Senator Von Fleitern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's a good question. As far as I know, the standards are you have to have a master's. So I'm really surprised that she's actually being paid and working as a speech pathologist in the school district. One of the problems our school district has is filling these exact positions because it does require a master's versus the normal bachelor's degree that a teacher or starting teacher would have. So it is to my surprise, and I certainly will make a phone call at the end of this to find out whether or not a master's is the standard for school district. In my understanding, it is the standard. So she may be working in that position, but if she's actually being labeled and paid as such, I'd be really surprised, but I will look that up.
See, Senator Bebout, did you want to do follow-up first?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a quick follow-up, too. Would you find out that if that's the case, did anybody talk about grandfathering? And maybe we need to, I'll look at the statutes. I haven't looked further about the master side of it. But I think we've got to be very careful here.
Thank you, Senator Bebout. Mr. Vice President, and then Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly in regard to the same conversation, if there would be some investigation in regard to a provisional certification in this instance, and then if there is a real lack in this particular position, if there in fact could be some sort of emergency provision in this case, and that would be part of the search.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Let me get Senator Scott here. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman. I think part of the answer to the question from the senator from Fremont County can be found on page 3, lines 9 through 15, where you see existing language be eligible for a license board, a person shall possess at least a master's degree in the area of speech pathology or audiology from an education institute recognized by the board. And then the new language comes in and talks of applicants to audiology licensing. And that's where the Standing Committee Amendment extended the master's degree requirement. We don't touch the existing requirement in this bill that you have a master's degree to get the speech pathology license. That remains the standard. That is not touched. If somebody has been working with just a bachelor's, that was the original requirement way back when. I suspect you're going to find that there's a grandfather clause somewhere that dates from when the master's degree provision was put in. But that, with regard to a speech pathologist, which I think was what the question was directed to, that provision is not changed by this bill.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Massey, do you want to pile in?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And going back to that same section, I think it's important to note that this bill will delete the words on lines 9 and 10 or its equivalent. I suspect, and I've worked with SLPs quite a bit, folks who don't have a master's degree but have a bachelor's degree and a great deal of experience built up were grandfathered in at the time it went to become a master's degree by putting or its equivalent. And that's the way it is right now, and that's, I suspect, how she got and kept the job after it was a master's degree. With the amendment that we just adopted, we're bringing that language forward again, saying a master's degree in audiology or equivalent granted before July 1st, 2012. So I suspect that she will continue to be grandfathered under that amendment that we adopted from the Standing Committee.
Thank you, Senator Massey. And Senator Massey, the term SLP is licensed pathologist or speech pathologist?
Mr. Chairman, it's speech language pathologist.
Thank you. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm struggling with this bill. I think it's a pretty high fence that we're building. Drive down the road and you see the fence along the interstate that's supposed to keep game off the, and every once in a while you find one's two fences high. And this bill kind of reminds me when it's two fences high. I'm troubled when we do things like this. The writ law used to say at least a master's degree or its equivalent, and then they're removing your equivalent. And my life's experience teaches me that you can sure acquire a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience without necessarily getting a college degree. And that's one thing that troubles me. The other thing that troubles me is the comment that was made earlier by some, and I don't remember which senator made it, but apparently there's enough speech pathologists here, and so that's all of a sudden this bill comes out, and it seems like we're starting to fence out. Let me just share with you the experience that's suffered by another professional association in the state. A number of years ago, the CPAs went along, and they decided that this was really important. They had enough CPAs, and they decided we needed to have, because of the advances in the technology and the technical aspects of accounting got a little bit more difficult, they decided that they would pass a law here that required you, because that was the trend at the time in the nation. You had wanted CPAs to have master's degree now instead of bachelor's degrees. And so it's probably been 8 to 10 years ago, Wyoming came and we passed a law with the request of the industry that there be a master's degree. The effect of that now is that a lot of states that were supposed to follow along haven't. My son, a recently graduate degree in accounting, is working for one of the big four accounting firms in San Francisco. Dad can burst these buttons when he tells me he was a top-rated associate staff member in that office, which is an office of about 1,200 people, in the last year. And he's got a bachelor's degree. They taught him. He's acquired the additional expertise and training. He's gone about and done that. Now, the effect of that is, as you talk with CPAs, you can't find a CPA to come to work in Wyoming now. Incredible shortage of CPAs. One of the reasons is because other states don't require master's degrees. And so before, where there was a surplus, now there's a shortage. And ultimately what's probably going to happen is I wouldn't be surprised to see a bill come back soon that you would lower CPAs back to bachelor's degrees. And so I'm very, very concerned when I see bills like this. And we talked about another bill earlier being a fencing bill. I think this one really is a fencing bill. And I think we ought to be very, very careful about what we do and how we look at this bill.
Thank you, Senator Perkins. Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it may be that in this debate that we've discovered that this or its equivalent language that you see on page 3 lines 9 and 10 ought to be restored on a second reading amendment. That may be, and we may need an explicit grandfather clause as well. And, you know, that's the process here. It's why we do these debates, is to find these things and make sure there isn't a problem. Mr. Chairman, this is not my bill. My only exposure to it was when it was heard in my committee. It's important to distinguish here that there is a difference between the speech pathologist and the audiologist. The doctorate requirement is strictly applying to the audiologist. That's a national push. And a number of states have gone this way because there is a national push. And because of that, the testimony in committee was the University of Wyoming had eliminated their audiologist program. They didn't feel they're capable of offering the doctoral program, and they eliminated the master's program because they felt the graduates were not going to be marketable. And if we were a large state, then I would say it makes sense to say, no, you're wrong, we're just going to stick with master's degree for audiology, and we could probably make it stick. As a small state, we're probably not in that position. But we are in the position to do as the Standing Committee Amendment did, that we'll continue to license the people who've already gotten the master's degree. Now, with the audiologists, you have a surplus. With the speech pathologists, different group, there we did not change, at least not intentionally change, the existing master's degree requirement, left it alone. What we did do in this bill is that we gave them a provisional licensure provision that they needed, because this helps ones that are in the process of completing their training that have a deficiency or two, that need the field experience, etc., to get that experience here in Wyoming with a real license. The current procedure for that purpose is not successful, and this will help us ease the shortage. It's an anti-fencing position. So we have taken down some of the fence with this bill in the speech pathologist area where we do have shortage problems. So I don't think you should represent this bill as a fencing bill. You may not approve of the Doctor of Audiology. That's a simple amendment. If you want to knock out that requirement, it may be ineffective because we're such a small part of the market. And if they succeed in doing as they have here already, knocking out the master's degree programs, we won't do any good. But in terms of the profession, there's a shortage here. This bill takes down a fence that's a problem.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Are you ready for the question? Senator Bebel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that my tall friend from Natrona County is exactly right, and I would disagree with my other tall friend from Albany County. I think if you eliminate or its equivalent on page 3, line 9 and 10, that only affects the pathologist, and the amendment doesn't go to that, speak to that. So I think that if this bill were to pass now, you're going to eliminate those people that have been practicing speech pathology in Wyoming for a lot of years, have a lot of experience, but only have a master's degree. I don't think that's the intent of what we're trying to do here.
Thank you, Senator Bebout. Senator Nicholas.
We're on the bill.
We're on the bill, Senator Nicholas. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess when I hear words, whether this is a fencing bill or not, I would like a little more talk on the top of page 2, lines 4 through 9, where we now want to prohibit the practice, if you will, by telephonic, telephone, any type of means, et cetera. I don't know of any other profession that we regulate where we go to such lengths to such this. And I can tell you that many of you get consultation from CPAs, lawyers, clear across the nation, and you get on the phone and you talk to them. If we put a provision like this in any other professional statute, I'm guessing it'd be struck down. But, boy, that, I'd like to hear more about it. That looks like the too high fence that I've seen. I can't see any justification for it.
Thank you, Senator Nicholas. Who'd like to address that? Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm a little lost here. The inclusion of that language is to bring us into the modern age that says people practicing through telephonics, electronics, or whatever are considered doing their trade through those mediums is just being covered. That's all we're saying. We're trying to avoid is them saying, well, I don't actually see the customer. I do it electronically, and so you can't so I don't need to comply with your standards to be an audiologist in your state. And all we're saying is if you practice in this state, whether you do it electronically or not, you need to meet our standards. That's what it's saying. It's not saying if you do it electronically, you can't do it. It's saying if you do do it, you still have to meet our standards if you want to practice in the state.
Senator Nicholas.
Well, that's exactly my point. I mean, believe me, there are, if you have a business here, the likelihood that you've, if you have a major business, the likelihood that you've called a Colorado lawyer with a specialty in an area of law, and what you'd be, if we had that in the law business, you couldn't call a Colorado lawyer, and he couldn't give you advice if he's practiced there, even though he might have a rare specialty that's not even available in the state of Wyoming. I have clients that consult with lawyers, doctors, all over the country that aren't licensed in this state and they're consulted with for specialty. And like I say, I know of no other profession where we say if you're a professional in another state and you talk to one of our citizens over the phone, you need to get a license first.
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me try to hopefully clarify that particular provision, because as the chairman of the Labor Committee indicated, this provision isn't building fences, it's tearing them down. You know, right now, there is a question on whether someone who's a speech-language pathologist or an audiologist can conduct her trade through through telephonic, electronic, or other means, or whether they have to be right there in that room with the person that they're testing. And so as a result, if you're a speech-language pathologist in Gillette and you don't have one up there in Recluse, the way that the law would read right now is that person or that school district or whoever up in Recluse has to go out and get a speech-language pathologist to and be there physically to do it, or get the person from Gillette to drive there. All this provision is saying is that if you have a licensed speech-language pathologist in Gillette, and you can connect that speech-language pathologist in Gillette with the patient in Recluse through a telephonic, electronic, or other means, that constitutes the practice of speech-language pathology or audiology, and then that person is licensed to do that. So you don't have to go out and get a second one to be up there in Recluse. So that's all this is doing. It's breaking that down. With regard to the point that was made by the tall senator from Riverton, he may very well have a point, and we may want to take a look at those particular words there in lines 9 and 10 on second reading, because that may be an unintended consequence of that. But we did grandfather those folks in audiology with the amendment that the standing committee adopted.
Thank you, Senator Massey. Further discussion on the bill? Further discussion? Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 98, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 98 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, what's wrong? In recess or stand at ease for 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. You've heard the motion. All those in favor? Hi. Yeah, better get hot. The Committee of the Whole will please come back to order. That's a good idea. Leave you off. That way you can cuss. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 97. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 97, Juvenile Hearings Timeline, sponsored by Representative Lubnow, an act relating to juveniles. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCarrier, and Ross. No, Senators Perkins and Sessions. Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 97. For an explanation of the bill, I'll yield to myself. yeah, it could happen again. I'm getting tired. somebody asked me if I'd have a Tony moment just so I could liven this place up.
Don't encourage him.
Okay. So, anyway, here's the bill. ladies and gentlemen, what Juvenile Hearings Timeline Bill seeks to accomplish is to address a major concern that the judiciary has, particularly our district court judges, with regards to the administration of juvenile cases in Title 14. The good former chairman of Appropriations prior to myself had opened a dialogue with the judiciary and met with their district court judges judicial conference, and I was privy to a couple of those meetings, and then we've continued those meetings during my tenure as chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And this year we had Chairman Buchanan and myself had a meeting with the district court judges with regards to one of our interim topics, which was the topic, of course, of juveniles. And they had two topics that they had voted unanimously to have us sponsor for legislation. The two topics were, one was to get rid of jury trial in juvenile cases, and the other was to this bill. Well, question.
Come on, you guys, take it easy on him.
So what happened was, after being thoroughly used and abused, we canned that bill, Chairman Buchanan and I, and because of the nature of the limits of bills, Representative Lubnow was gracious enough to address the number one issue of the district court judges, which was the time frames in which they would actually have trials, judicatory hearings in juvenile cases. So that's what this bill does, and addresses the one issue that was really, really important to them. And because of my lack of spine, chose not to press the jury trial issue, mainly because there's just very few jury trials in juvenile court, so it really doesn't make a difference one way or the other ultimately. So what happens here? This bill goes into your various statutes in Title 14 with regards to the hearings and how they're held and the time frame in which they will be held. The problem, as presented by the judiciary, is this, that initially you would have, in juvenile cases, you admit or deny the allegations, you may first have a shelter care hearing. That's the first thing. And then subsequent to a shelter care hearing, you may then have your initial appearance where you would either admit or deny the allegations. And then that would then be subsequently set for hearing. Now, in most of these cases, you also have MDTs and other things that are going on at the time. And the complaint of the judiciary was is that by the time, with the time frames that were currently in the law, they were actually going into court, having to hold a hearing, and hadn't even had an opportunity to see the MDT report because of the time short time space. So what this bill does is does the same thing throughout, and that's basically to go in and says that after you've had your hearing where you admit or deny the allegations, the court will set a time for a hearing, and the previous law was time not to exceed 60 days from that point. This bill would take that to 90, unless the court finds for good cause, and that was in the language before. The court could grant a continuance, but no event under the previous law for 90 days, have to be 90 days out, and this would take this to 120. But there is a difference here, because in this case, what we're doing is we're saying from the time of denial. So in essence, and you'll see that, for instance, on page 2, line 15. So we're going to say from the time of denial, not from the time it was filed, which was the way it was in some cases, from the time of denial, you got the court should has 90 days to set a hearing, and no more than 120 days if there's good cause for a continuance. In essence, it's about a 30-day window, additional time for the court to hear your juvenile cases, and that is the basis of this bill. Ultimately, the real reason for the bill is that you have better opportunity to have a fair hearing in which all parties have an adequate time to be represented, and that the court has an opportunity to be fully informed when it makes disposition of these children. Now, on the other side of the coin, there is the argument that perhaps by granting or allowing this continuance, you're having children that may be placed temporarily or perhaps even longer, you're extending their time in which they may be in foster care or court order placement or whatever before they actually get a hearing. So it's a trade-off, but this was the number one thing that the district court judges felt would assist them in dispensing fair and equitable hearings in their courts, and that's what this bill is about, and I'd stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Ross. Questions for Senator Ross? Questions? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, particularly in the juvenile cases, it seems to me that we have a special obligation to do things rapidly, that I think the longer time you get between the action and the consequences of the action, the more difficulty you have getting the association between the action that got the juvenile and this kind of thing and the consequences for it. And I am a little concerned with this bill. Number one, that we've made our systems a little too complicated to the point where we're defeating things. And number two, that we're stretching this out for the convenience of the people that run the system as opposed to the best interest of the child. And I think the faster we can do it, the better we serve the interests of the child. And so I really wonder if this bill is striking the appropriate balance. And if maybe we ought to say to the judges, look, this is very important that it be done rapidly. Do what you have to do to speed the process up, because you can lose the fairness by taking too long as well.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Let's get Senator Schiffer first, and then you can answer both. Senator Schiffer, Mr. President.
Chairman, and I think it's along the same lines. Is the driver in this, is that because we instituted that GAL program and our is that gumming up the works? But what I want to say is, because we've got GALs now coming into the process on their behalf, is that what's bogging this down and making this unwieldy, or am I, is that totally out of the picture? I'm trying to figure out what broke on this or what's happened over the last couple of years.
Thank you, President Shiffert. Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to address, first of all, the concern that I failed to mention initially in my presentation for the good senator from Natrona. Call your attention to the fact that we've passed a bill, and I'm not even actually certain where it is now, but I'm sure it's moving along, and that is where we've, early on now, we've said before the shelter care hearing, there has to be an interview and an assessment of that child within 24 hours, and that has to be done before the shelter care hearing. So we're getting some earlier intervention in there to make sure we know what we're doing at the time of the shelter care hearing. Now, Senator Scott makes a very valid point, and that's the issue is how do you balance to try to do the timeliness to get early resolution, get some permanency, or get try to move towards permanency for these children, and how do you and the administration of justice? Well, the reason the judiciary had suggested getting rid of the jury trial issue was for that very issue of delay, that many attorneys are using the request for a jury trial to delay the proceedings so that they can get prepared for a hearing. And ultimately, jury trials don't happen very often. However, there are a number of reasons that I've learned since then why it's probably still a good idea to keep a jury trial issue, particularly in abuse and neglect charge cases and so forth. But having said that, you also run into, and the good the president is correct, in the GAL area, the provisions that we made for GALs, one of the issues that has come up in these cases is now GALs or attorneys, because the GALs represent the children, particularly in abuse and neglect cases, where now the parents, who generally, and most of the time in these cases, don't have a lot of financial resources, and we're having to get attorneys for them. So, there are some problems in this area, and hopefully by moving the GAL system over to the Public Defender's Office, we'll have better accountability and deal with that. But these are just some of the technical issues that occur in trying to handle these cases. The other issue, quite frankly, is when you look at district court judges' dockets now, the things that are eating up their time are criminal cases and juvenile cases. I mean, that's the bulk of their cases. This at least allows the court to have some flexibility, because in certain situations, for instance, under current law, from the time of a denial, they only had 60 days. And they're just not getting, you're talking about, first of all, a lot of this stuff with all these assessments and everything else that we brought into the program and all these MDTs and everything else, and everybody's well-meaning and trying to do the right thing, there's a lot of stuff that has to happen. And the court is sitting there, and he's going to have to try to make a decision and doesn't even have time to even see the reports before they're actually having to have a hearing. And so in terms of administration of justice, that's probably not a very good thing, because you surely will want to make sure that he's had the opportunity to read the reports and to see those reports and to make sure that we're doing the right thing for these kids. Because ultimately, if you lose that, we may not be administering justice at all for these children. So trade-off is some timeliness versus good justice for the kids.
Thank you, Senator Ross. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm opposed to this bill, and I'm going to tell you why. Management audit a few years ago did a study on court-ordered placements. One of the problems is they would get a placement. They would have a placement hearing. The placement hearing was often done before they even had a report on the kid. And that's true, and that isn't very good justice. But the problem is, once they were put there, they languished. And they'll sit there. I mean, I think 60 days is too long, myself, and you're going to give them 120 days if they're not placed in the proper kind of a setting, which often they are not, because they don't even have the placement report or the team done before they're put in that placement. 60 days, in my judgment, was too long for a juvenile to sit in an area where he may not be receiving what he really needs. And to give him now 120 days in order to be able to let the judicial system deal with them when they're languishing there somewhere they may not have to be is wrong. It's just clearly wrong. In my judgment, speed in seeing that they're properly placed is more important than being able to say that they had exactly the process they needed. That's what management audit showed, is that they were being put there and all of, they're there for 60 days and shouldn't have been in that maybe facility in the first place, but there's nothing done about them for that period of time. In my judgment, we should be going the other way, not giving the legal system more time to do with it, to deal with it, and I would urge you to reject the bill.
Thank you, Senator Larson. President Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to figure this out, but when we reorganized the judicial branch, we gave those different judges the ability to bring another judge, either bring another judge in or bring another judge up and say, you handle, I'm busy, you're authorized to handle this case. Is that system broken? Is that, you know, they're not using it, or they're not comfortable using it, or they don't want to use it, or I'm trying to figure out, and maybe the timeline's right, but I'm trying to figure out what broke all of a sudden that we're having this difficulty, and I don't mean all of a sudden, over the last couple years, and yet this is exactly one of the areas in 2000 when we started working on that, saying how can we provide good use of a judge, an appropriate judge at whatever level we need him to take care of. For example, juvenile cases, and I happen to agree with my colleagues, time is of the essence. But we gave them, and it was like dual, you know, where we said, if you get overloaded, you can assign this. For example, if you got a circuit court judge with his feet on the desk, put him to work and let him do some of these tasks. We're not using that, or that didn't work, or what happened there?
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll take Senator President, Mr. President's question first. We do allow circuit court judges in certain situations, in certain cases, to sit for the district court. But we do not do that in juvenile case. We do allow, for instance, here in Laramie County, we have a circuit court judge that sits every week and hears, post-divorce motions or paternity cases, but not juvenile cases. That is strictly reserved to the district court. Now, on the issue of whether or not the district court judges are sharing or helping out in other districts that have heavier caseloads, I don't know that I can answer that question. They do have the ability to do that, though. The management audit on this area was, my recollection of that was that the strongest criticisms were on the fact that we weren't having timely reviews of the adjudicatory hearing, and we weren't having a resolution of permanency done. And so you had children without maybe not even having a hearing for a year or two. Now, what we're talking about is the first adjudicatory hearing. Remember, there's a shelter care where the court, where we've tried to address and make sure that the court has an assessment and so forth of that child at the time of the shelter care hearing. And then you get into an issue where they then appear before the court to enter their plea. And then when do you have the adjudicatory hearing to determine should this child be placed somewhere? This bill does not change, and we've really increased the number of reviews, which also does affect the court's time, the number of reviews that they've got to have, and a decision ultimately for permanency or return of the child, hopefully back to the home. We've done and have maintained strict protocol with regard to that. So, you can see both sides of the issue. You want to make sure that the child isn't languishing somewhere. But by the same token, you want to make sure you have the opportunity to have a good hearing. And that's the balance. Ultimately, because of the way in which we've done this, in this bill, from the denial of at the time of the denial of the petition, and that's where everything runs, the timelines run, you're basically giving the court a window of about an additional 30 days to have the hearing.
Thank you, Senator Ross. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to also give you an idea, at least of my experience in a county as a county commissioner and not as an attorney dealing with those issues, it really has come and elevated significantly in the last 3 to 4 years. And it used to be that as you ran a juvenile hearing in, they were pretty quick, although the times may have not been right, but they were fairly quick and fairly uncomplicated. The files are fairly thin, and attorneys, right or wrong, are handling very, very substantial caseloads and running them through very quickly. And about 3 years ago, and partly in response to the GAL program that was done, it's a factor, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's a cause. What's happened is these cases have become increasingly more complex. The files are thicker. There's more research being done. The effect of actually paying somebody to help the child instead of saying here's $150 a case, or saying now that we'll pay you to do the work, what you're finding is a couple of things. One is that the attorneys are much more prepared, which is a good thing. But the other side of that is that they have cases. They ensure that the rights of the child and the rights of the parents and all those people are being met and established now, and that becomes a very complicated process. And ultimately what you have now is although jury trials in these situations are very, very rare, it's very common to have a jury trial requested. And the reason they do that is to get additional time because you need to visit with experts. Your GALs are visiting the families and the kids. The attorneys are doing discovery. They're getting ready to go to a jury trial in 90 days. That's an incredibly short period of time. And they're doing that. And so what they're doing is they're going in and preparing for trial, and then typically there's a resolution and it's dismissed, and you'll find that there's an agreed-upon resolution. There's a dismissal just within a day or two of when it would go to trial. And so it's a combination, kind of a storm of a number of things that have come together. You'll find, at least our experience in the central part of the state, is that the budget and what's spent on GAL and with the county attorney and others in actually representing the county and other attorneys representing parents, as these cases have become very complicated. They take much longer than they used to take, and that's part of a process of ensuring constitutional rights and other initiatives that this body and the other body have undertaken to make sure that those rights are undertaken. And so you've got a situation where the entire system has become more complex, and it takes longer for that to drive through at this point in time. The judges are doing the very best that they can. I don't think anybody's purposely not trying to do what they're doing or to avoid doing it or doing it promptly. And to go back on one point that the good chairman said is initially keep in mind there's also initial hearing. That you have to have, and there's already been a bill that's gone through here, and I think it's made its way through the other body, that there's an interview and there's a meeting with that kid within 24 hours of them being taken into custody. And that report has to come back in that initial hearing. That happens very, very quickly, typically within, I think the hearing has to happen within 72 hours. So there's initial consideration about what happens with this kid in the interim. It's not that there's Nobody's paying attention, and nobody's looking, and nobody's trying to take care of these kids. It's just the opposite. There now is a 20. If the bill that was passed earlier becomes law, the initial interview will happen within 24 hours. The shelter care hearing happens within 72 hours, and then the rest of this process takes place after that. So it's understandable to be frustrated because it's not happening quickly. Part of that is the processes that we've put in statute that have drawn this out and made it more complicated.
Thank you, Senator Perkins. Anybody else? Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, my fine chairman across the aisle almost convinced me that this is what we should do. And then I stepped back, and I have been opposed to this bill from the beginning for the simple reason is that we've had a long history of this in our body. And we know what happens to our kids in Wyoming. First of all, when you go into one of these hearings, picture this. You have to place a child somewhere. Where are you going to put this child? We don't have, if we had therapeutic foster care for those children that needed it, we don't have very many of those. Our foster homes, we're struggling for foster homes for children. So where do they go? Okay, I just got an email from a judge, my judge, who I just think the world of. I've known him since we moved here. He said, what we need is more detention centers in this state. We don't have enough places to hold them. No, I have to, but this is extending it 30 more days that a child is taken out of a home and is put somewhere. Oftentimes in Wyoming, they're taken out of their home. There isn't the places in their communities for this child so they can continue to go to school, can continue to have any kind. They're jerked off somewhere else. So, you know, I understand judges, and I try to understand them, and I support them. With every vote I've made on this floor, I support judges. But it is not a good idea to extend these back out once again, because every report we have tells us that the expediency and deciding what to do with that child is the most important thing that we can do. And so I've had my say, and I'm not saying anymore, but I will tell you, I have stacks of juvenile justice reports and research, and this is not the right thing to do.
Thank you, Senator Sessions. Anybody else? Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 97, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The bill has failed. Let's have a standing division. All those in favor, please rise. All those opposed, please rise. Having failed a standing division, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will take the roll. Oh, I'm sorry. Hold on. Let me turn on the chief clerk microphone.
Anderson. Anderson. No. Allman excused. Bebout.
No.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
No.
Coe,
no.
Cooper,
no.
DeCaria,
no.
Fecht,
aye.
Geis,
no.
Hastert,
no.
Hines,
no.
Jennings,
no.
Job, Johnson,
aye.
Landon,
aye.
Larson,
no.
Massey,
no.
Meyer,
no.
Mockler,
no.
Nicholas,
aye.
Perkins,
aye.
Peterson.
Aye.
Ross.
Aye.
Scott.
No.
Sessions.
No.
Townsend.
No.
Basie.
No.
Von Flatern.
Aye.
President Schiffer.
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 10 ayes, 19 noes, 1 excused.
House Bill 97, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. Chair would apologize for being ineloquent in their remarks. Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
You certainly may.
Mr. Chairman, I hold in my hand the Federal Register from February 27, 2008. The U.S. Forest or Fish and Wildlife Service hereby establishes a distinct population segment of gray wolves in the northern Rocky Mountains of the United States and removes this DPS from the list of endangered and threatened wildlife. Don't get too excited because there's 11 organizations that are now suing.
Thank you, Senator Jennings.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 17. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill number 17, Community College Commission duties, sponsored by the Education
Act Relations
Community College.
Sorry. Can we do that again? Would the reading clerk please read the bill again? I didn't have your mic on.
House Bill 17, Community College Commission Duty, sponsored by the Education Committee, an act relating to community colleges. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, Cole, Jennings, Massey, Von Flatern, Senator Cole, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, that reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Job, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Reading Clerk. Senator Coe, you've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, I move when the committee the whole rise and report to do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 17. House Bill 17, brought to you by the Joint Education Committee, is a summary and a recommendation that has come about from the Blue Ribbon Task Force that worked on community college issues last year. Roughly 11 recommendations came back to us for our consideration, so this bill includes most of those recommendations. It comes in and clarifies and imposes additional duties on the Community College Commission, requires collaboration with the Department of Education for post-secondary education options, and has a lot of reporting requirements in it. As you walk through the bill, you'll see on page 2, this particular report here in paragraph J talks about the foundations that the local community colleges have and how they report back to the treasurer, governor, and the Community College Commission. At the bottom, you'll see that we start the powers and duties of the commission at the bottom of page 2. The first, in paragraph B, talks about the coordination function. In performing these coordination functions, all affected colleges and the commission shall be involved in it. Over on page 3, you'll see where there's a, the paragraph continues where you can request a new program. This is actually can be done in a service area county by the county commissioners of that area. It shows how the Community College Commission will respond to that request. Paragraph 7 on page 3 talks about the coordination of a statewide strategic plan. That's one of the recommendations that was in the request here. Bottom of paragraph 3 and paragraph C, it talks about the administrative functions that the commission shall perform. It talks about maintaining service areas in paragraph 8. Goes over to page 4. Paragraph D gets into the approval functions. One of the key things here is that in paragraph 2 little I, the commission shall review existing certificate and degree programs and terminate those programs with consistently low enrollment. The rest of the page 4 is just a renumbering provision. Over on page 5, we get into the review and report functions. Paragraph 2, little I on page 5, talks about the auditing, the uniformity of the audit procedures. Audits and report financial and enrollment audit findings to the legislature and the governor. Paragraph A under 2 little I talks about the uniform accounting and creates the one full-time equivalent new position to come in and ensure uniform accounting and reporting of FTEs. Moving over to page 6, it talks where the commission can participate with the financial audits with the local colleges. Paragraph 5, paragraph A on page 6, talks about the performance, the report on performance back that comes back to the legislature. Page 7, this is the part that talks about the interaction between the Wyoming school boards and the community colleges and UW for secondary enrollment, post-secondary enrollment for students that are at the K-12 level. It talks about the collaboration. Bottom of page 7, we talk about the Joint Education Interim Committee, the College System Strategic Plan, and then, Mr. Chairman, Section 3 talks about the appropriations for $250,000 for this effort. There is a standing committee amendment, Mr. Chairman, and I would move that at this time and ask it be read in.
Thank you. Chief Clerk will read the standing committee amendment.
House Bill 17, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 4, line 8.
Senator Coase, move that amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that amendment, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 17. We came in page 4, line 8, and changed consistent to consistently, made more grammatical sense. And in page 5, line 19, we weren't insuring anything. We were insuring stuff, so we changed the word insure to ensure. That's all the amendment does.
Thank you. That should ensure its passage. Discussion on the amendment. All those in favor of the Standing Committee Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment is carried. Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, you do have another Standing Committee Amendment, and I try to answer questions on the bill and deal with the other one whenever you want to.
Senator Nicholas, do you want to do the other Standing Committee Amendment now? Let's have the reading clerk read the Standing Committee Amendment.
House Bill Number 17, Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to engross copy, page 8, line 5.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 17. Ladies and gentlemen, we reduce the budget authorization, expenditure authorization for $250,000 down to $150,000. After taking testimony, it just appears to us that the task can be done by the lower amount.
Thank you. Discussion on this second Standing Committee Amendment. Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, since we appeared in front of appropriations that day, I've done some looking into it, and I'm going to ask you to defeat the amendment. The $135 is for the full-time equivalent that will be involved in the enrollment auditing. But we have put a number of other duties upon the Wyoming Community College Commission, including in Recommendation 1 here that's in the bill, the authority and funding necessary to employ external auditors. As I go through the other recommendations, that the Wyoming Community College Commission be required to provide aggregate and individual college reports to the legislature. Recommendation 7, and this is all in the bill, that the Wyoming Community College Commission be authorized to ensure that all community colleges are reporting information in a consistent, accurate manner. Recommendation number 9, that consolidation, transfer, or termination of programs be added to the Wyoming Community College Commission's authority. So they do have a number of added duties that this legislation requires, and with that, I would ask that you defeat the Standing Committee Amendment.
Thank you, Senator Coe. President Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I too would ask you to defeat this amendment. What we're asking here is considerably more than just coming in counting noses at the community colleges. If you followed what that task force did, and as they traveled around, there is absolutely no consistency from one college to the next on how they count students, how they define full-time equivalents, how they rate, what a program's efficiency is. There's nothing. That's part of the problems that we're having in trying to figure out what to do with community colleges is you cannot compare figures one to the other. And understand what we're talking about. This is a $230 million program. And it is, for all practical purposes, defunct because nobody knows exactly where the money's going or why it's going there. In addition to that problem, you're being asked to fund a new funding formula based on FTEs, of which there's no such critter statewide as an FTE. It depends which county you're in. We got blue ones and green ones and yellow ones and striped ones and some that are Lancers and some that are Tigers. And I mean, there's all sorts of them. But the critical thing is they're all defined differently. And until we get a handle on that, we do not know either who's there. We don't know what they're learning. We don't know if what they're learning is what we thought they were learning. And sadly enough, there is no way to hold any of those seven community colleges accountable. This is a relatively sophisticated job. It's a question of going in and trying to figure out, one, what's there, and then how to make it so it's usable information. So I urge you to defeat this amendment.
Thank you, President Schiffer. Chairman Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I guess just to let you know how the thought process is that we went through. First of all, the administration Series 100 for the commission is $6.6 million. The justification for the expenditure is as what is described. They asked for an employee. That was $130,000. We asked for accounting with respect to what is the plan. Show us what you're going to expend it on. Ordinarily, we would expect a list and say, this is where we're going to expend our dollars. And so they have a $250,000 swag that says, well, we don't have a list. We haven't made a judgment with where it's going to be spent. I have no doubt they can spend the money, but we do expect when bills come in that you provide to us a spreadsheet that says, here's where it's going to go. And with the $130,000 was explained. We added on to that another $20,000 to come up to the $150,000. They have a contingency fund of $1.6 million. They have ongoing administrative cost of $6.6 million. And when you read the task, and I appreciate everything that has been described as the task we're being asked them to do, what we didn't receive is an explanation that they're going to do tasks that are not already put in their budget with outside employees. If they're going to consult, fair enough. Give us a list. Here's our consultants. That's all we ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Further question? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The amendment has passed. Division being called. All those in favor, please rise. All those opposed, please rise.
Our power is being dwindled.
The amendment has been defeated. We're back on the bill. For discussion on bill, Senator Coe. Sorry, Senator Scott.
I've got a question for the proponents of the bill on the new language on page 7. Lines 13 through 17, and this is in the area of the post-secondary enrollment options. And, Mr. Chairman, I think that's a program that is working very well now, has provided a lot of students with an option. And right now, the old language is additional student eligibility requirements shall be based upon criteria established by the university or the community college, and which I think is entirely appropriate. So so that we make sure that it really is good college credit material or good material heading toward an appropriate vocational certificate, which my district has done. And then we add on this new language, and let me... The question I've got is, what are the practical implications of that new language? And my fear is that you'll have some fencing going on with making it more difficult for students to do this because it does transfer some of the workload from the high schools to the community colleges. I think the way we've done it, where the student gets double counted for enrollment, it's been appropriate because given incentive for this very good program. But I really want to know what the practical implications of that language are and what's the problem that it's trying to address.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that probably by bringing the collaborative effort, bringing the Department of Education into it as well, I think maybe defenses this thing a little bit. I think it even defenses it more. You know, this is a great program where we allow some of our really aspiring high school students to take post-secondary courses. So I think with the collaboration of the Department of Education coming in and as it says, address the high school grade level, uniform prior curricular requirements, academic achievement levels, and national examination performance indicators. That brings that's the new language that comes in. And I think it defenses rather than fences.
Thank you, Senator Coe. Ready for the question on the bill? Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Neither on or against this bill, but just a couple of thoughts that I have to share. My good friend from Teton County said the other day that the train's probably already left the station, and I suspect that that's the case in this particular bill as well. But, you know, what we just did is something you can take home with you and say this is how we grow government. Because there's one provision in this bill that says we're going to audit some things. Well, be assured of the fact that these colleges, each one of them, have certified CPAs auditing the internal auditors. So now we're going to have the Community College Commission step in and we're going to audit the auditors who are auditing auditors to begin with. I wonder if we've asked the Community College Commission about FTEs. I understand the frustration of our president, and I fully respect some of his thoughts, but I just wonder if some of these tasks couldn't have already been asked of the commission now. If we're having a problem matching FTEs with seven colleges, isn't there a way that we could have asked that become consistent? I just don't know if we need that $250,000 expenditure. That's how we grow this thing right here. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Landon. Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, and I too am concerned if we're growing government unnecessarily. But understand, and this was laid out both at the task force meeting in Sheridan and the one in Rock Springs, we're not questioning where the money's going. We know it's all getting spent, and we know when they cut a check, it's going to the person that's entitled to the check. But if you look on page 5, we're asking for something considerably more than that, and something that is absolutely lacking in the community college system. We ask for uniformity in audit procedures. We're saying you're all seven community colleges. There should be some sort of standardization so that when you read the balance sheet, so to speak, of a community college in the western part of the state or the northern part of the state, somehow they ought to look similar. And they do not. If you ask them to show it, they don't look the same. We also ask that they report it in the same format so we can look and say, well, are we comparing apples to apples? But it's the next line is really where the crunch comes. We want to conduct enrollment audits. How are we going to count FTEs? That's what that means. We're going to spend $230 million based on FTEs. You better know what an FTE looks like. And they are not the same college to college to college. And folks, until we take that step, I'm not accusing them of spending the money the wrong place or cutting bad checks or anything like that. I'm saying it's a slippery slope when you don't even know what an FTE is and you're going to allocate that kind of money on the basis of that. And understand, that task force was dominated by people with a vested interest in protecting and enhancing the community college system, and they agreed on this. They absolutely agreed that they recognized that there were lots of things they did not agree, but this is one they did agree on. I urge you to support this. We got to start somewhere. And when they agree on it, that's probably as close. I'm not going to go there. I urge your support for this.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Meyer first, and then Senator Coe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is really for the good senator from Cody. And just maybe some further explanation about the paragraph on page 2 at the bottom that continues over to page 3. It appears that the county commissioners are entering into the area of a program development. And at the end of the paragraph, it says the commission shall provide a response under this program. Oh, we're under this paragraph. I'm just kind of curious as to the genesis of this. If anybody that was on the commission or on that select blue ribbon panel or task force could maybe get us up to speed what the discussion was on that and how it might interplay with future program development.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator Coe?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could, just to follow up on what the President said, if you also move on back to the auditing function, if you also move on to page 6, on the next page, paragraph C, if you look at that language there, it says the Commission may participate in financial audits conducted by each community college and assist in the analysis of audit findings for subsequent reporting under this paragraph. So I think maybe, I hope that gives the good senator from Natrona County a little more ease there. Back to what the good senator from Goshen County talks about, bottom of page 2, going over the top of page 3, this has a lot to do with requesting a new program. And it has a lot to do with requesting a new program in a service area. And I might defer to the good senator from Gillette if you wouldn't mind commenting on that, but if, for instance, in my district, Northwest College in Powell, Bighorn County might come up with a program they'd like to see in their service area or see some follow-up. The county commissioners are the tool that they've chosen to do that. At least I think I'm correct in that.
Thank you, Senator Coe. Senator Von Fladen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A quick answer is exactly what this good senator from Cody said, was that if Culinary Arts in Central or Sheridan and Converse County is requesting that kind of program and Eastern says, well, you know, that's not something we have. The cost is this big deal to get that going. We'll go to Sheridan, or you can go to Sheridan. But there was no process in place to do that. So what they did was they said, we'll make the county commissioners that asking entity, and then they'll go to the college commission or have the answer from the college commission, and the local community college that cannot provide it shall refer them to them. So it just didn't stop with Eastern saying, we don't do culinary arts, and then Douglas or Converse County being kind of stuck in the middle because that's the district serving them. So we just put something in place, and the entities that will do the asking, and that's all that is.
So are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 17, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate file or House Bill 17 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 48. The reading clerk will please read the file.
House Bill 48, State Loan and Investment Board Loans, sponsored by Representative Berger, an act relating to State Loan and Investment Board Loans. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, that reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Fecht, and Vasey. No, Senator Larson. Senator Cooper, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Cooper?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises and reports, that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 48 do pass. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment that I'd like to have read in at this time.
Please.
House Bill 48, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 2, line 17.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fellow senators, this amendment is just where the committee felt that we should have a conforming amendment in here rather than an actual percentage, because this is what the legislature has been going to over the last few years, and it's called the LDI, or the Legislative Designated Investments policy, and that's what this is all about. This is, like it says, it's on page 2, line 17 and 18, or where the amendment has been made, and it just says the average rate of return realized on all permanent mineral trust fund investments as determined by the state treasurer for the 5 calendar years immediately preceding the year in which the loan is made. In other words, this is not a floating loan. This is just a way to determine the percentage that they're going to charge on the loan before the loan is made. And, Mr. Chairman, with that, stand for questions.
Senator Cooper.
Oh, I need to move it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Okay,
how about if you do that?
Mr. Chairman, I move a standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 48.
Thank you, Senator Cooper. Questions on the amendment? Questions on the amendment? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senate Standing Committee Amendment number 1, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Back on the bill, Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for a explanation of the bill, I yield the floor to President Schiffer.
President Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is it really does just two things. This is one of the legislatively designated investments. It's so that we included the university under this program, so that where they have things like dormitories or bookstores or those type of things, they can borrow money to build those at a very low rate of interest. And that helps develop our university and our community college, particularly as it applies to those ventures where they raise money. We've already changed the interest rate. The other thing we do on page 2, line 10, we change the amount allocated to this LDI from $30 million to $60 million. This is strictly a way so that if we want to expand on our university campus or on our community college campus, they have the ability to do so. It's very straightforward. It's enabling. What I think you'll find, depending on where the interest rate is with this LDI, those institutions will run the numbers, and they'll figure out whether they want to borrow from the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund or borrow from some other place, but this just empowers them to do that. I'd be happy to answer any questions and ask for your support.
Thank you, Mr. President. Are there any questions? Senator Larson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you'll note, as you did, that I voted against this bill in committee. And I'm going to quote our president, as I have opposition to this, if I may. And some of the quotes will be very familiar. I voted against this because this just absolutely is not the time to do that. They're going to, all of the testimony was they're going to build some dormitories and they're going to do the other things, all which will affect the formula that's known or unknown. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, let me quote Our community colleges, there's red ones and blue ones and green ones. Mr. Chairman, there is no accountability. The formula is flawed. We don't know what it is. We don't know how to do it. We don't know how the dorms are going to build are going to affect anybody. There is no uniformity. Enrollment audits are necessary because their FTEs, which will determine the need for all of these, are a joke. Now, let me also say that in the committee, the university really didn't want this. They didn't care. It was the university was really put in because, frankly, it'd make it sell better. The university didn't want it. They said they would probably never use it. I'm not against the program. I'm against the program now. We should not be providing another method of financing for the community colleges to go out and build things that are going to enhance their part of the formula, be they red, blue, or green, and let them do it at this time. If you want to come back after this group has worked on the community college formula, done the things that are necessary to straighten out the accountability, the uniformity, all of those things that the good president mentioned as he was talking about the other bill, then I say fine. We don't want them out building new buildings and dorms and those kind of things until we get a handle on the whole community college situation. I think it's a bad thing to do at this time. We can come back in a general session after we have all these reports when we know if they go out and borrow the money to build a dorm. Is it just because of the fact that that's going to increase their allotment? Or is it because there is a real need, because based on some kind of reliable FTE? So I ask you to vote against it. We can come back and do it. It just is the wrong time to encourage them to go out and be doing the very thing that we're talked about in some of the other bills. The very thing. This is just another means for them to do that. So let's just put this thing to rest. They can come back after we have all those problems that the president referred to solved, and then go ahead and give them some additional means. But not now, folks. Not now, when we're trying to get a handle on the whole program and they're going to jump out ahead because of what it may affect or do to their college and their budget. So I ask you to vote against this bill.
Thank you, Senator Larson. Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, and you're low these 14 years. I didn't think he was listening. I don't know whether to be pleased or saddened. I think before the day's done, I'm going to be a lot sadder, I'm afraid. Mr. Chairman, understand that there is a distinct difference between an FTE and the dollars associated with an FTE and empowering a real, actual, flesh and blood student to attend a community college. And what we're talking about, when we start building dormitories, particularly self-sufficient dormitories, is a place for a real person, not an FTE, which is a calculation that goes into the coffers of the community college, but for a real person to enable them to go to school and get, whether it's a certificate for a higher paying job or an AA degree or work on their master's degree or attend a course that comes out of the university that's up at Natrona County. If you look, one of the biggest inhibiting factors why students can't get those higher degrees and those higher skills is there is no place affordable for them to stay while they're doing their study. And I don't care, go to Rock Springs. Try and find an apartment or a hovel or even the backside of a parking lot where a student can live while they're going to school. There just are none. They just are none there. Absolutely none. Go to Gillette. Go to Sheridan. try and find an apartment or a hovel or a parking lot where a kid could hang out while he's trying to improve his ability to earn. None there. Go to Casper and see what rents are. They are exorbitant. If you want to really help a physical person, this is the bill that does it. I may criticize the administration of those colleges and say we need to work on them. We'll get to that. But right now there's a need in this state to empower our young people and our non-traditional students to get those skills that they need that'll lift them up. And first of all, they got to have a place to live, physically live, because there are none in many of our communities. I ask for you to support these kids, whether they're red or green or Lancers or what else did I have them as? Whatever else I had them as. They deserve our support.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Vasey.
Mr. Chairman, a question that throughout this whole community college debate that I need answered, and I am on the bill, but this whole debate kind of reminds me, there was an old Irish land buyer in Rollins, and he didn't have much land, but he had a lot of sheep, but that was another story. But one day this young man used to run the business out of the Ferris Bar, which is torn down, but this young man came in and asked him for a job, and he said, yeah, he did need some help, and he asked the old young man, he said, go get your bedroll. And the kid said, I have no bedroll. And the old Irishman said, he said, you're the man I've been looking for all my life, the man that needs no sleep. And this is what we keep talking about workforce development, but we keep building them places to lay in bed. So if somebody could answer that.
Thank you, Senator Vasey. Are we ready for the question? Or Senator Larson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's been a lot of talk on this bill that it would be, I think the term was self-sufficient. I asked a question in committee of the prime sponsor. I said, is this going to be self-sufficient because it's going to pay for itself through rents and so on, or is it going to be self-sufficient because by building a dormitory, you're going to increase your share of the formula, and so you're going to get more money into your community college because you're building a dormitory to manipulate the formula? The answer I got was, I don't know. It may increase revenue. It may do all of those things. Do we need to build dormitories, as our good president said? Absolutely. I don't think anybody questions that. I do question allowing that at this time for another year before we have this whole community college thing figured out and how the funding is going to go. You heard testimony on other bills that were here about building the dormitories in order to take advantage of what it would do for the formula. This leaves this wide open. And look, we need them. We'll build them. We can do it, but we don't need to do it this year in the budget session.
Thank you, Senator Larson. Are you ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of Senator Cooper's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 48, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The bill has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion from the Majority Floor Leader. What is your pleasure? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Thought maybe I'd have a mutiny. I'm very sorry about that.
Would the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 57, do pass amended. House Bill 57, do pass amended. House Joint Resolution 1, do pass. House Bill 44, do pass. House Bill 109, do pass amended. House Bill 134, do pass. House Bill 98, do pass amended. House Bill 97, failed to pass a committee of the whole and was indefinitely postponed. House Bill 17, do pass amended. House Bill 48, do pass amended. Senator Case, Chairman.
Senator Case.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
The motion is to adopt the Committee of the Whole report. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion is carried and the Committee of the Whole report has been adopted. Standing committees. Okay, let's see. Let's do reports from standing committees. Those are always fun.
February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 10, engrossed, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Ullman, Burns, and Massey. No, Senator Coe, excuse, Senator Mockler, Senator Burns, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 92, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, Jennings, Mockler, and Ross. No, Senator Case, Senator Anderson, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 86, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Cooper, DeCarrier, and Larson. No, Senator Case, excuse, Senator Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 107, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, Case, Jennings, Mockler, and Ross, Senator Anderson, Chairman. February 28, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 133, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, Case, Mockler, and Ross. No, Senator Jennings, Senator Anderson, Chairman. February the 28th, 2007, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 3, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Job, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 33, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Job, Peterson, and Townsend. No, Senators Meyer and Nicholas, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 42, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Job, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 75, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Job, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 151, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, Case, Jennings, Mockler, and Ross. Senator Anderson, Chairman.
Mr. Vice President.
Mr. President, I'd like to request the re-referral of the following bills to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. House Bill 92, House Bill 151, engrossed. 92 is engrossed also. And, Mr. President, finally, House Bill 107. And, again, I would like to have those re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 92, House Bill 151, and House Bill 107 are re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Senator Burns.
Mr. President, House Bill 10 has an appropriation. I ask that you re-refer it to Committee Number 2, Appropriations.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 10 is re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Messages from the House.
February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 10, Mental Health and Substance Abuse Appropriations. Ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. House Senate File Number 67, Salaries for Officials. Ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives, message number 209, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File Number 6, Cost of Emergency Detentions Limitations. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 59, excused 1. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives, message number 216, conferees appointed, Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with a like conference number 1 from the Senate on amendments to Senate File 9. The House conferees are Representative Olson, Chairman, Representative Escobel, F. Escobel, Representative Gingery, Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. That's Floyd, I couldn't think of.
Senator Burns, are you ready on message number 211, the concurrence request for Senate File 51, Mentor Hunter Program?
Yes, President.
February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives, message 211, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File Number 51, Mentor Hunter Program. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 59, excused 1. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, I move concurrence of Senate File 51 and ask the Senate to vote aye. Mr. President, over in the House, all they did on line on page 2, line 17, all they did was remove the words 12 years old or older, and mostly because that was superfluous and doesn't affect the bill itself. And so I ask the Senate to vote aye.
The motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate File 51, Mentor Hunter Program, and you are being asked to vote aye. Would the Chief Clerk please call the roll?
Be Bout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
DeCaria?
Aye.
Fecht?
Aye.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hines?
Aye.
Jennings?
Aye.
Job?
No.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Larson?
No.
Massey?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Mockler?
No.
Nicholas?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Sessions?
Aye.
Townsend?
Aye.
Basie?
No.
Von Flatern?
Aye.
President Schiffer?
Aye.
And Senator Massey, can I check your vote?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Closing. Larson, no to aye. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 25 ayes, 5 noes.
By your... Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm not sure that is correct because there's only 29 members on the floor right now.
Oh.
So the 25 to 5 vote may not be correct.
Almond's excused. Excuse me. 24 ayes, 5 noes, and 1 excuse.
By your vote, you have concurred. You have voted to concur on Senate File 51, Mentor Hunter Program. Senator Burns, are you ready on message 215, Senate File 69, Wildlife and Natural Resource Funding Amendments?
Yes, Mr. President, I am.
Would the reading clerk please read in the bill?
February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives, message number 215, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 69, Wildlife and Natural Resource Funding Amendments. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 46, noes 14. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, I move concurrence of Senate file number 69 and ask the Senate to vote no. Mr. President, the House added an amendment in here that I don't think is workable on a practical case unless the Oversight Committee wants to have a full-time job. So I'd like to go and discuss it with the members of the other body and see what their thinking is and see if we can come to a meeting of the minds.
Motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate File 69, Wildlife and Natural Resource Funding Amendments, and you've been asked to vote no. Would the Chief Clerk please call the roll?
Anderson?
No.
Allman excused. Bebout?
No.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
No.
DeCaria?
No.
Fecht?
No.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
No.
Hines?
No.
Jennings?
No.
Job?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Landon?
No.
Larson conflict? Massey?
No.
Meyer?
Aye.
Mockler?
No.
Nicholas?
No.
Perkins?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Ross?
No.
Scott?
No.
Sessions?
No.
Townsend?
No.
Basie?
No.
Von Platern?
No.
President Schiffer?
No.
Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 1 aye, 27 noes, 1 excused, and 1 conflict.
By your vote, you have failed to concur on Senate File 69, Wildlife and Natural Resources Funding Amendments. Senator Nicholas, are you ready for concurrence on message number 209, Senate File 6, Cost for Emergency Detentions Limitations?
Sir, I am.
Would the reading clerk please read in the bill?
February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives, message number 209, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File number 6, Cost of Emergency Detentions Limitations. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 59, excused 1. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendment. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move message number 209 for Senate File 006 and ask that you vote aye. The House just inserted some language to the, addresses the cost for emergency detentions, and they want to clarify that the treatment that would be paid for includes assessment of and or necessary treatment for. It's chicken soup. It's okay.
The motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate File 6, and you are asked to vote aye. Would the Chief Clerk please call the roll?
Anderson?
Aye.
Allman excused. Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
DeCaria?
Aye.
Becht?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hines?
Aye.
Jennings?
Aye.
Job?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon? Larson?
Aye.
Massey?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Mockler?
Aye.
Nicholas?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Sessions?
Aye.
Townsend?
Aye.
Basie?
Aye.
Von Platern?
Aye.
President Schiffer?
Aye.
Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 29 ayes, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have concurred on Senate File 6, Cost for Emergency Detention Limitations. Senator Nicholas, are you ready for a concurrence request on Senate File 55, Appropriation for the Legislature?
I am.
Would the reading clerk please read in Senate File 55?
February the 28th. 2008, from the House of Representatives, message number 212, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File number 55, Appropriation for the Legislature. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move concurrence message number 212 for Senate File number 55. There were two amendments to, this is the feed bill, there are two amendments to the feed bill. One is for the IT request for $100,000. That was made by our legislative staff to seek appropriations to help advance our website. That was actually advanced in the requested in the Appropriations Committee on the House side, which approved it and went through all three readings. And finally, there was an amendment to add $25,000 to allow reimbursement for legislators-elect to attend meetings before they are sworn in. That seems an appropriate thing. We have new legislators, and it is appropriate, it seems, to have them attend meetings and be at least get their per diem paid. So I'd urge you to vote aye.
The motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate File 55, Appropriation for the Legislature, and you have been asked to vote aye. Would the Chief Clerk please call the roll?
Anderson?
Aye.
Allman excused. Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
DeCaria?
Aye.
Vecht?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hines?
No.
Jennings?
Aye.
Job?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Larson?
Aye.
Massey?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Mockler?
Aye.
Nicholas?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Sessions?
Aye.
Townsend?
Aye.
Basie?
Aye.
Von Flatern?
Aye.
President Schiffer?
Aye.
Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 26 ayes, 3 noes, and 1 excused.
By your vote, you have concurred on Senate File 55, Appropriation for the Legislature. The Conference Committee for Senate File 69, Wildlife and Natural Resources Funding Amendments, will be Senators Burns, Massey, and Geis. Senators, we are at that order of business of signing of enrolled acts. Enrolled Act Number 1.
Enrolled Act Number 1, being original Senate File 2, and Act relating to the Select Committee on Natural Resource Funding.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act Number 1, same being the original Senate File Number 2. I have so signed. Enrolled Act Number 2.
Enrolled Act Number 2, being original Senate File 3, an act relating to game and fish.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act Number 2, being original Senate File Number 3. I have so signed. Enrolled Act Number 3.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 3, being original Senate File 4, an act relating to foreclosure and redemption of realty sold under mortgage and execution.
Enrolled Act Number 3, being original Senate File Number 4, I'm about to sign. So forth and so forth. I have so signed. Enrolled Act Number 4.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 4, being original Senate File 17, and Act relating to school facilities.
I am about to sign Enrolled Act Number 4, being original Senate File Number 17. I have so signed. Enrolled Act Number 5.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 5, being original Senate File 32, and Act relating to parole.
I am about to sign Enrolled Act Number 5, being original Senate File Number 32. I have so signed. Enrolled Act Number 6.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 6, being original Senate File 49, and Act relating to taxation and revenue.
I'm about to sign Enrolled Act Number 6, being original Senate File Number 49. I have so signed. Enrolled Act Number 7.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 7, being original Senate File 52, and Act relating to construction of statutes.
I am about to sign Enrolled Act Number 7, being original Senate File Number 52. I have so signed. Enrolled Act Number 8.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 8, being original Senate File 61, an act relating to school finance.
I am about to sign Enrolled Act Number 8, being original Senate File Number 61. I have so signed. Enrolled Act Number 9.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 9, being original Senate File 64, and Act relating to juveniles.
I am about to sign Enrolled Act Number 9, being original Senate File Number 64. I have so signed. And Enrolled Act Number 10.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 10, being original Senate File 68, an act relating to judicial retirement.
I am about to sign Enrolled Act Number 10, being original Senate File Number 68. I have so signed. We have more messages from the House. Cool.
February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives. Message number 217, concurrence passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed. No, Mr. President, the House did concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 30, Modernization of Court Procedures, Ayes 60. House Bill Number 36, Uniform Law on Notarial Acts, Ayes 60. February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives, message number 219, concurrence failed. Mr. President, House Bill Number 55, Water Well Drilling and Pump Installation Licensure. The House failed to concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 26, noes 34. The House requests the Senate appoint a conference committee, number one, to meet with a like committee from the House of from the House to report recommended amendments to the bill for final consideration by both houses. February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives, message number 220, concurrence passed. Mr. President, the House did concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill number 89, ownership of subsurface pore space. Ayes 59, noes 1. February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives, message number 221, conferees appointed Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to House Bill 55. The House conferees are Representative Dirks, Chairman, Representative Teeter, and Dave Zwanitzer. Patricia Benskin, that's Dan Zwanitzer. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears this desk.
Mr. President, I move the Senate be adjourned until 10 a.m. and for the first time in 4 years on February 29th.
Are there announcements? Senator Education, Senator Cove.
Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, will meet tomorrow at 8 o'clock over here in S11 by the smoking lounge to take up, and we're going to change the order a little bit. The first bill we'll take up is House Bill 117, Engrossed Developmental Preschool Funding, and the second bill, House Bill 102, Quality Child Care.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the usual committee room. First thing we'll do is a confirmation hearing for Gary Child, Director, Department of Employment. Second item will be House Bill 127, Prescription Drugs Physician Shopping. And the final item, if time permits, will be House Bill 118, Loss of Chance Doctrine Abrogated.
Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, Water Resources, will meet in about 3 minutes on House Bill 106, Sheep Feedlot Exportation Permit, and House Bill 143, Memorial Hospital District Use of Levees.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet immediately upon adjournment to conduct a hearing on the Governor's nomination of Bruce Salzberg for the Office of Attorney General and Anthony Lewis for Director of Family Services. And then tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., your Judiciary Committee will meet to hear the following bills: House Bill 43, Engrossed Penalties for Domestic Violence, and House Bill 83, District Court Judge Increase.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President, and I sort of apologize for this notice. The Conference Committee on the Budget may or may not finish up tonight or may go in tomorrow. So in order to accommodate that, the following bills will be heard at 8 a.m. unless we're working on the conference bill, in which case we'll move it to 1 o'clock and on into adjournment. So if you just check with our secretary at 8 a.m. and by that time, or actually we'll know before then, but if we finish the conference tonight, we'll start these bills at 8 a.m. If not, we still may do it at 8 a.m. and move the conference to 9, but if you'll check with us in any event. Committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet tomorrow at 8 a.m. or after there as appropriate to consider the following bills: House Bill 52, Engrossed Developmental Programs Cost-Based Reimbursements; House Bill 74, Engrossed Veterinary Loan Repayment Program; House Bill 82, Trauma Care Services; House Bill 113, School Finance Minimum Teacher Resources, House Bill 85, Engrossed Brucellosis Testing Program. And if that's too inconvenient for you, let us know. We'll work the sponsors' schedules. We also are going to have a hearing tomorrow after adjournment to consider the position of Director of A&I, interviewing Mike McVeigh.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet tomorrow immediately upon adjournment in S-18 to consider House Bill 132, Surveyors and Engineers. And if time allows, before we go into the interviews, House Bill 169, Engrossed Contracts for Public Improvements, Bid Requirements. We will beginning at about 12:45 to interview the governor's appointments for John Stoll, Community Development Authority, Gary Negich, Business Council Board of Directors, Donald Russell, Business Council Board of Directors, Pamela Snell, Community Development Authority, Edward Lum, Community Development Authority, and Nathan Becky, Business Council Board of Directors. They will all be done by telephone.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will meet immediately upon adjournment to finish off House Bill 108 and to take interim topics.
Senator Hines.
Mr. President, your committee number 12, Rules, will meet at 9 a.m. in your office to take up House Bill 69, Revisers Bill.
Senator Jennings.
Mr. President, the ALEC group has asked that you join them at their reception tonight. They've been at it for about 30 minutes, so the light hors d'oeuvres and the beverages might be growing short.
Can I get a conference committee for you to see if you want?
Further announcements? Senators, I'd like to take a moment, and before we adjourn for the day, to thank the staff for the Salad by Committee. I truly think it's one of the outstanding meals we get, the ability to visit and talk and to see former staff members that we only see about once a year, but it's just great. It's a great occasion, and I just would like to thank all of the staff and have you join me in thanking our staff members for Salad by Committee. Thank you, staff. We surely do appreciate it. Any further announcements? The motion is that the Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, February 29th. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.